Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first quarter wrap-up with Dr. Joseph Farrell for News Trends and Stories. I'm here at your home, Joseph, sitting in front of Bruno, the organ. Shiloh is in with you. And anyway, but thank you for the opportunity to come into the heartland and do this recording. So we ended the annual wrap-up talking about the extraordinary pushback, and we predicted 2024 would essentially be Operation Pushback. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've seen for the first quarter. I really want to encourage everybody to access the website for the first quarter wrap-up. It's linked in the commentary. And there is a wealth of information. Brad Edens, our News Trends and Stories wrap-up editor, who you finally met, Joseph, after all these years.
Yeah.
You've been emailing with him, but we finally had a wonderful meet and greet here in somewhere in the heartland. And you got to meet Brad. It was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank everybody who came out for that.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for inviting
me. It was a lot of fun. Our theme is the opportunity to lead financial freedom at the U.S. state. So U.S. state's opportunity to lead financial freedom. For part one of News Trends and Stories, normally we cover the first 10 stories. Today, we're going to, Joseph has agreed, we're going to go through the theme, which we will record separately at another date for the first quarter wrap-up. But I wanted to go through an overview of the theme before we do the first 10 stories for part one, because they bear so much on the story. So we'll spend less time on the individual stories, but focus a little bit on where the state's leading for financial freedom and what needs to be done. And of course, this is valuable resources for you to work with your state legislators. And now is the time, you know, everybody's pushing back. Now is the time to get off the couch and start taking action and pushing back. So part one, the overview, the first 10 stories. Before we dive in, Joseph, any overarching thoughts?
I think, no, let's just dive in and we'll tackle it that way.
Okay, well, what has been very interesting, if you look at our theme, we start off with the fact that what needs to happen, both at the state legislatures and local, is to really understand the nature of the control grid that's coming.
Right.
And we're starting to see more and more really excellent leaders looking at the various things snapping into place for total control and basically saying, oh my God, it's really that nuts. And there are two things. There's an opportunity to stop tyranny, but there's also an opportunity to convert from a going direct reset to a building wealth reset. So it's really a two-step thing, stopping the control grid, stopping the tyranny. And then the second thing is saying, okay, we do need a reset. How do we do it? How do we build wealth? And of course, this is all about centralization versus decentralization. So where are the leaders who are going to lead the decentralization in a way that both stops tyranny, but also moves us back into being a really productive society? And that's important because as I drive all over America, people's productivity is being ruined as as we've noticed today in our food fight to get set up. Anyway, so step number one is to get that vision of, okay, I'm going to stop the control grid, number one. And then number two, you know, let's get busy on building a wealth reset. The second thing is not every leader wants to take responsibility to do it. You know, you have leadership, you have legislators who really feel, okay, well, the control grid is the way it's going to go. So let's, you know, let's just go with the flow. Mm-hmm. And then you have others who are afraid and, you know, find the whole thing overwhelming. And then you've got a third group of people who are saying, we're going to take responsibility and do this. And their biggest challenge, Joseph, which will not surprise you, it's back to the red button story, which is, you know, there's the state and federal constitution, but then there's central banks printing gobs of money.
Right.
And whether it comes from injections in the central bank and the investors they play with, or it comes through the fiscal mechanism, the tsunami of money looking to buy everybody into demonic behavior. Mm-hmm. And yes. I won't even say lawless, because it's worse than lawless.
No, it's worse than that.
Yeah. So it's quite extraordinary. Anyway, so I would say that's why if you look at the leadership that's leading, you know, mm-hmm. they are precious beyond imagination and deserve our support. What they're doing is, you know, they're engaged in spiritual, legal, financial, political warfare of the first order. And I don't know, it's a great time to be alive and see that leadership. It's very heartwarming for me. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's look at their 12 steps that I think, you know, states and other groups can take to preserve our financial freedom. And I want to just go through the overview. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to start with our good old favorite, and that is preserving cash and checks.
Yes, hear, hear.
Yeah.
Hear, hear.
So I'm seeing, you know, it's hard to trust the statistics, but we've seen two statistics. One is that in the United States, people are moving the community bank deposits are going up and the big banks deposits are going down. And mm-hmm. even the Fed is reporting that. So mm-hmm. that's how bad it is. And I get reports from all over, more use of cash and checks.
Good.
So I think people are onto it. And, you know, there's a lot the state can do to encourage cash. One thing is to mandate it. Mm-hmm. Tennessee has always taken the position that they don't want to mandate private businesses to do things. So right. they don't like that. And instead, what one representative, a bill one ran this year that I just love, and it didn't make it out of committee, but I would love to see it go through, and I'd love other states to pick it up, was any purchase paid with cash for $500 or less, no sales tax.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, that's a very good idea.
That's a very good idea, and it's a great incentive.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about cash. Everybody knows how to do that. But checks are having a revival, and it's mm-hmm. funny because the young people don't know how to do checks. And yeah. everybody, all the old bees are busy giving the young bees instructions on how to use check. I just explained to somebody, yes, you write out the number in longhand on that line underneath, you know, above the signature. Was funny. I thought, whoever thought I'd have to instruct people on how to use
check. How to do that. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So the second one, and this is a really important one, and that is a sovereign state bank.
Here.
Right. And the goal of a sovereign state bank is we want to make sure the state and the citizens and the banks within the state can make transactions without being turned into the Canadian truckers.
Yes.
Absolutely. And we have seen so many different mechanisms being put into place to basically control the digital and telecommunication systems centrally, so that literally the payment, you know, the state taxes are collected in ways or held into accounts
right.
that are controlled in, you know, in Washington, New York, and Boston. And right. it's amazing. You go to the states, and it's true for Tennessee. If you look at where they have their bank deposits and you look at where they keep their pension funds and securities, they're all up on the East Coast.
Yeah. Let's emphasize this in a slightly different way, because you have been pointing out, and we'll get to this later with some of your other points, and once we get into this idea of state sovereignty. But we've been watching this phenomenon of bullion depositories and state constitutional money resolutions and so on and so forth. And you pointed out, and a bunch of people pointed out when I did that blog, you weren't the only one, that, you know, this bullion depository business on the part of states could be a trap.
Right.
And I, you know, I agree with that, you know, and the problem is, what the states are doing could go either way. The essential step that will prevent it from becoming a trap is the establishment of a state bank.
Right, right. And I'm a great believer that states should do bullion depositories. I think it's a very good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Just like the central banks want to have gold and have right. a safe depository.
right.
for their gold, which is why the Germans and everybody else is taking their gold back from the,
yeah.
Right. They see the writing on the wall. So,
right.
So, but I think for the same reason all the central banks around the world want a bullion depository, it's a great thing for a state to do.
To do. Right.
And it's a great service for their citizens. And we'll get into that because I've written a lot about this, but you're right. Without the ability to transact dollars, they are going to be in a squeeze. And I want to make sure
you need a financial system that can bypass the Fed. That's ultimately what you're doing is you're creating a clearing system. And we'll get back to this later because there's some news that people need to know. But yeah, I think it's an absolutely essential step. If they're going to have a bullion depository, they need a sovereign state bank.
So
that's simple.
So I want to make sure everybody understands it because the folks who are promoting Bitcoin or who are promoting gold and silver as you know, they're calling it sound money. Mm-hmm. What you have to look at this as a gaming or a economic warfare playbook. So the citizens of any state in the United States, maybe 3-5% have precious metals or Bitcoin. 100% have dollars. The central banks and the people who run the central banks have plenty of gold and silver and plenty of Bitcoin, right? But the citizens don't. So if you create a sound money system that is dependent on what is scarce for you and plentiful for the central bankers, they've got you over a barrel.
Yes.
And now you've got to sell your land or your business to get the money you need to transact, right? So they've got you in a short squeeze.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Right. So one of the problems that the states have in doing a state bank is some constitutions don't permit it. And what I've argued is that if you have a constitution that doesn't permit it, it is also possible for the state banks to organize a private bank that is a dedicated depository. So it doesn't have to be owned by the state. It can be owned by the state chartered banks, and they can create a new bank that's just a depository that serves the state and is dedicated to making sure there is financial liquidity under the legal jurisdiction of the state and operationally within the state so it can't be shut down.
Yeah, they could, another way that they might approach the same problem is, and I was going to talk about this later, but this is as good a point to raise it as any. And that's the idea that you're already seeing some states arrange compacts with other states about how they're going to do certain things. And we've talked about this in some of your previous wrap-ups recently, that with the bullion depositories, you're going to see automatically emerge regional state compacts. And you could have one state that does allow a state bank compact with another state to become the depository for that state, on and on it goes. So I guess what we're getting at here, folks, is that you need to think outside the box of what you can do to protect your local sovereignty and to be able to transact in case the Fed decides to do any sort of overreach.
Well, the first thing the states can do is just, you know, compare notes. There's been a tremendous amount of sharing of information back and forth. So we were asked to draft a bill to outlaw NACs in Tennessee, and we shared that broadly and it flipped around. So if you look at the extraordinary amount of legal and financial thinking and working and design that needs to be done, there's tremendous communication going back and forth between the states. And, you know, one of the things I've seen is particularly the southern states are very cooperative and collaborative. And it was funny, somebody said, you know, if all the southern states from Texas to Florida do this, it's the American OPEC.
Yes.
They have the oil and gas to back this up.
Right.
Okay, so several states have published, no state that I know of has moved a bill to start a state bank, but that several states have published resolutions to require studying and or a commission. And I think that's a, you know, what you want to encourage your legislatures to do at a minimum is to do something like that. And we'll have links to some of the resolutions that have been done so you can see them. But we want to encourage them, to, you know, encourage your state legislators to look at that, because without having dollar liquidity, there is going to be a land grab. I mean, there's a land grab going now.
Going now, right.
Right. Okay, so item number three is protection of financial integrity. It's great to have a state bank, but also, you know, whether you have a state bank or you don't, the question is, how are you going to, you know, how is every agency, how is the treasurer, how is all the different agencies that have to transact going to make sure that their systems have integrity? And it's not just if the feds shut you down, it could be a power outage that shuts you down. It could be, you know, a tornado in Tennessee that shuts you down. It could be all sorts of reasons for digital systems, games that private companies play.
Right.
So I think it is very important that states and their different agencies say, okay, how do we make sure we have financial integrity, both analog and digital?
Absolutely.
And then how do we make sure our digital systems are under our legal jurisdiction and control? You know, one of the things that frightens me as you see people approve and agree to all these different terms and conditions, how do we know if you're using Microsoft that the state of Washington doesn't have jurisdiction in your state?
Right.
It's very scary.
I would add to that, that if you're going to try and ensure your digital and analog financial integrity, that analog is the basis for the digital integrity, not the other way around. In other words,
right,
you have to be able to transact in cash in the case right. of an emergency.
Absolutely. Or checks.
Checks. You know, absolutely.
The checks is an open clearing system, so it's
right.
still relatively
right.
free.
Right, exactly.
We've seen bills outlawing CBDCs.
Yes.
And removing them from the definition of money or the definition
yes.
of deposits.
Right.
And I think that's a great thing to do, and it's a much mm-hmm. simpler thing to do than start a state bank.
Right.
But I want to say it's not enough, because
it's
unless
not.
unless you have the ability to transact independently,
right.
you have to have the operational capacity to back it up.
Yes.
Otherwise,
absolutely.
they've got you over a barrel.
Yes.
I just did an interview with Darren Moore, who's an expert on crypto. And I said to him, if you could ask the state legislatures to do anything, what would you do? What would you ask them? And he said, privacy. Privacy.
Yes.
He said, you've got to fix the Bank Secrecy Act. You've got to fix this, all this know your customer stuff. You know, apparently lots of people who trade crypto are getting thrown off of out of their bank accounts.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's what he said. So, you know, and of course, we're seeing people thrown off of their bank accounts for ridiculous reasons.
Things. Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's one of the reasons you must have a good bank, a community bank or credit union where you have a relationship. But privacy is also another area. And we're starting to see, we saw one legislator in Tennessee run a bill about PayPal throwing people off and trying to stop PayPal. And, the states can do a lot to say to banks, you know,
well,
if you're doing this to folks, you can't bank here.
Well, one way to do that goes way back to something that I mentioned, I would imagine, 5 or 6 years ago on one of your wrap-ups. And that was that corporations from now on, we have to get states to start thinking in this way. That any corporation chartered to do business in their state has to have the Bill of Rights as a part of their corporate charter. In other words, they must acknowledge.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah, they have to have it, because right now they don't. And if a corporation is a legal person, you know, then this sets up the two-tiered system of
uh-huh.
law that we see. And I've been advocating that if you're going to have transaction privacy, then part of the charter must be that corporation incorporates those articles, the first 10 articles of the Constitution, as its corporate charter. In other words, they cannot behave against that law.
I'm gonna ask Carolyn to take a look at how we could do that, how it could be done. That's
yeah.
a very interesting idea, Joseph.
Yeah.
Okay. Item number four is private currencies and credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that you can implement a total control system just using banking systems and credit cards.
Yep.
And one of the reasons we have seen the adoption of MCC codes, which are merchant codes, mm-hmm. which can be used to discriminate against certain businesses. So mm-hmm. in Tennessee, we're seeing lots of legislation relating to saying, okay, you can't ban, a credit card can't ban its customer from using its credit card to purchase firearms. So there's a lot around the Second Amendment in this. But I believe merchant codes, as applied to either credit cards or similar systems applied to banks, can basically implement a social credit, you know, so can combine social credit with a financial system without CBDCs.
Right. Yes.
Right.
So, I agree.
And of course, part of the private currency issue is, can private currencies like Bitcoin and crypto, other forms of crypto, and community currencies occur? So one of the things I would love to see is community currencies all over the country.
I think that's going to happen. And the reason I think that's going to happen, Catherine, is as you have all of these states adopting resolutions that do not recognize central bank digital currency as money, the plus side of this, or the positive side of that, is as these states have passed their constitutional money, their bullion depositories, in their regional compacts with each other, they're going to have to specify what the valuation of a unit of currency is in order to make interstate transaction independent and not dependent on the Federal Reserve. So they're going to have to do this as a matter of law.
Well, but they're going to need prices to float.
Exactly.
So. Exactly.
In other words, they are going to, what we're talking about is exactly the same situation that the Confederacy was in after the secession. How are they going to set up a system of currency? Well, the interesting thing is immediately they rely on a legal tradition of what the definition of a dollar is.
Right.
This is implicit. When they start making their own currency right off the bat, this is implicit.
Well, but the states aren't planning on making their own currency.
I don't think yet. But I think an inevitable consequence, Catherine, of a sovereign state bank and transactional privacy is you've got all the infrastructure set up to do so if necessary. That, I think, is crucial.
Right. But if you look at the extraordinary liquidity of the dollar and the extent to which everyone has it.
Right.
What you don't want to do is you don't want to leave the dollar unnecessarily because then you put yourself in a short squeeze.
Right.
Right. And I think what we want are we want robust tools for communities and families to transact. I mean, that's what freedom is. Let the market decide what works.
Right.
And the other thing is, constitutionally, the states have the ability to use gold and silver. They don't have the legal power to create their own currencies. Now, you know, if the country breaks apart and you have secession, then it's a different matter. But communities, private currencies can occur.
Well, even there, my point was, if you look at the Confederate currency, they're not breaking with a dollar. It's still something, it's still a unit of currency denominated in dollars, and that in turn was reliant on a legal tradition. So it's interesting. What they do is they set up their own infrastructure, and I think that's what we're seeing happen. And I've thought this from the get-go, you're seeing the deep state of the states, so to speak, acting now in a way to reclaim their state sovereignty. If it becomes necessary, what they appear to me to be doing is setting up the necessary infrastructure so that they don't have to go through what the Confederacy did during its secession and create literally in an instant an infrastructure for financial clearing. Right. That had to be done on the spot and on the fly. And the problem was when they did it in the Confederacy, their first Secretary of the Treasury comes right out and admits that we're having to do this without any precedent.
Right.
We're having to invent all of this as we go. I think what you're seeing now is a cautionary tale that they're setting up the necessary infrastructure if it comes to that.
So, well, if you look at the state legislatures, I mean, essentially you have bodies of lawmakers who, for the last, since World War II, have ridden the wave of centralization.
Yes.
And more central bank money pumping through the federal government into the states. So now, if you look at the percentage of money coming into any county in America, I would say it's approximately 50%. Mm-hmm. I saw one number the other day that said it was 42%. 50% is coming, you know, from the federal government. So you're centralizing the economy. So everybody's sending their money to Washington, then, you know, Washington dribbles it back in exchange for, you know, loyalty to the empire, so to speak.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And it's highly, highly centralized, and it's highly, highly centralized in a way which is phenomenally uneconomic. Mm-hmm. And what the states are struggling with and local government is struggling with is there's enormous amounts of decentralization that wants to happen, an enormous amount of economic imperative to do things on a decentralized basis.
Right.
But this, you know, the central bankers, you know, if you keep rigging elections and then rigging central bank, a tsunami of central bank money, you're constantly being bought out of doing things lawfully into doing things in either an uneconomic way or criminal way. And, the tension has become, I would say, pretty unbearable. But if you're a legislature, you're now being called to reinvent the decentralization. And that's, you know, I have to say it's an overwhelming responsibility. Mm-hmm. So to a certain extent, we're back to having to reinvent everything. So let's quickly go to precious metals. And we spent a lot of time on the Salieri report on the precious metals. But obviously, having a state bullion depository makes an awful lot of sense. Makes an awful lot of sense to pull the sales tax and capital gains taxes off of gold and silver. One way to do it is to give it legal tender status. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is how to give it legal tender status without having to make every government agency accept payment in gold and silver, which is a logistical nightmare, particularly before you have a bullion depository. So there's a lot that states are doing. And of course, the first one is to buy some gold and silver for their reserve funds. And to make it, you know, to make sure it's a permitted investment for the pension funds. Anyway, now what's interesting is we've had a couple of very, you know, entrepreneurial companies show up with transaction systems that allows you to use your, you know, to put money in a state bullion depository and then to use a MasterCard to transact with.
Right.
And it looks all very appealing until you realize, if we try and use this as a currency and nobody has any gold and silver except the central banks, we're toast. Now, we just published a great article by Corey Lynn and her researcher Sharp Edge on the role of MasterCard and Visa in building the control grid. I took one look at this and I said, wait a minute, you know, MasterCard is leading the creation of the control grid, including with EMCC codes. Why would we want to integrate MasterCard into our state bullion depository?
Well, this is why I blogged about that. I blogged about this very story, Catherine. That's when you and a bunch of other people sent me emails saying, oh, be careful of the trap. Well, I know it's a trap for several reasons. My first problem with the bullion depository idea, Catherine, has always been something that I go back to that I've said, and I've never backed off of this, is that after World War II, we simply do not have any good idea of how much bullion is actually in existence.
Right.
And the reason why it could, our figures, our estimates could be off as much as an order of magnitude. And if they are, then that allows the manipulation of gold and silver prices by the central banksters. That's my first problem with it.
Right.
My second problem is the MasterCard idea. When I read that, Catherine, I'm like you. I flipped out when I read that.
Well, here's the thing. It's a beautiful. Well, but if you look at the company that was doing the MasterCard, you know, it's a beautiful thing that they've created. It's very clever. It's very beautiful. You can have gold and use, you know, keep your money in gold and then go, you know, transact and travel and do everything. And it would be great if they could just use, you know, a different card.
Well, if they could use a card, let's put it this way. My argument in the blog was, okay, if you're going to use a card, you cannot have it be a card with your name on it. It should be just a number like a Swiss bank account, and that card therefore will function as a bearer certificate. In other words, the card replaces a paper, silver, or gold certificate. There has to be absolute anonymity for that convertibility to work. If there is any connection of the person who owns that card to the card, then they've got you. If there's no privacy, if there's no anonymity, then they've got you. And that's not what I mean by convertibility.
Right.
In other words, the card has to function like cash.
So it would be great if the card could function like cash. At some point, somewhere, there's going to be data connecting it to your account because
that's
you're drawing
my
on your gold.
With it. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know if, you know, there's a great deal that can be done for privacy, but I don't know if you certainly can't get all the way, in my opinion, on that. But what you can do is you can have a card that's not part of the MasterCard operation, and you can have a card that functions under the jurisdiction of that state law. So, you know, it's important to have something that operationalizes the transactions that is under the law of that state. If the gold is sitting in the state's bullion depository, you want the state to have jurisdiction.
I'm uncomfortable with any idea of a card, and I will remain so. The problem is, as you have pointed out many times, there is no cyber system that's secure. What I want to get from my bullion depository is a sheet of paper like this, with a valuation of how much money I've got on that depository, and it's issued to me, the bearer, and I can use that certificate and buy groceries or take it to my bank and exchange it for silver
dollars.
But
there's no reason a state bullion depository can't do both.
My point. They need to be able, you're unwilling to do that, then you don't have convertibility and you don't have anonymity.
Right. But let the residents decide what they want. In other words,
I'm perfectly willing to go along with that. But as a matter of principle, if we're only going to go with a card, then it's not a system that I'm going to back.
Absolutely. Right. No, I have to be able to have actual precious metals sitting in the vault. Right. And it would be great if I can liquefy it with paper, you know, not just with a card. Absolutely.
Right.
Okay. So anyway, but there's a world check out. Again, on the website, you'll see a world of links to different examples. Okay. So now I want to turn to me, what is the most important part of the sort of building wealth? And that is direct and local investment. So right now, I can go down to the local grocery store in my town of Hickory Valley, Tennessee, and I can spend $1 million on the lottery. But if I was to invest in, if my local grocery store was to sell stock to the local community, we would all go to jail. Right. So I can't put $10,000 to invest in my local farmer's market or my local grocery without spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on legal expenses. And, you know, I'm exaggerating, but trying to create local venture pools or local deals or local investment is a legal nightmare. You know, everything is designed so that all my money flows into Wall Street. Mm-hmm. You know, I put it in a big bank. I put it in a brokerage account, and it all flows up to Wall Street. And again, if you look at the state, you know, whether it's the pension funds or the reserve funds, all the money is flowing up to Boston and New York and Washington. So one of the things I've proposed, and this is a complex area, and it's the area, I think, once you get the state bank and the state bullion depository working, then you go to work to facilitate the making it easier for equity to flow locally.
Right.
But one of the things I've recommended is that states start the equivalent of a Treasury Direct. So Treasury Direct is you go to Treasury and you can buy Treasury mm-hmm. bills and bonds directly mm-hmm. by sending your money to the Treasury. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many local investors, you know, gold and silver is wonderful, but people need to put money in an investment and get a yield.
Right.
And right. and yields are very attractive now. Even, you know, on a bank CD, you can get 4 or 5%, or, you know, on a good, you know, on a good corporate bond, you can get 4 or 5%. So, and, you know, even more if you go longer, lower credit quality. But I can't tell you how many people in the States that I know who, if they could go directly to the Treasury Department for their state mm-hmm. and buy municipal bills and bonds, would love mm-hmm. to finance the state mm-hmm. directly mm-hmm. instead of, you know, needing underwriters who issue on Wall Street or competitive bid on here. Wall Street. And you, you know, so instead of going into their brokerage account, you know, I would much rather put money in Tennessee than I would in a big brokerage account.
You
know, and yep. it's a great form of diversification. Now, it's a complicated thing for a treasurer's office to set up. So, you know, this has to, if you're looking at doing a state bank or a state bullion depository, that's plenty of work for a treasurer. But I think on the list and a real opportunity is to give citizens the ability to finance their state and local government directly and not have to work through Washington or Wall Street to do so.
Talk about a cash and liquidity boon for states that, you know, that gives them the ability to tap into amounts of cash that normally they wouldn't be able to access at all. You could create all sorts of opportunities for states with that. I know, right. For example, I know that I would be willing to invest what meager little bits I could if I were able to go directly to my local state treasury and, you know, buy a bond for so much money. Absolutely.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you look at, I think part of having a good state bank is creating the infrastructure.
Right.
For, you know, if you look at the history of the Bank of North Dakota, which is the one state that still has a state bank, many states used to have them. But if you look right. at Bank of North Dakota, you can tell they have a board and they have a staff that are keenly interested on how to facilitate local investment and right. and local economic activity. And just having that wealth of people dedicated to doing so, I think, is a valuable reason to have another valuable reason to have.
Well, a good way to do that is you could make the bank the treasury agent for each state and allow it to sell those bonds. And if that were the case and you have privately owned banks as part of your state right. network, then they can become agents too. I mean, you could set up the infrastructure in my way of thinking, you could set it up. It'd be difficult initially, but once you got it set up, I think it would work like clockwork. And you'd have a fresh supply of money for states that you don't have right now. I think that's just a wonderful idea.
Well, the other thing states need are an independent infrastructure of people expert in IT and telecommunications to give right. them privacy and integrity in their financial systems right. and telecommunication systems. So the, you know, Tennessee has a great network of technology centers, and I would love for those technology centers to be teaching encryption and cryptography so that you had thousands and thousands of people throughout the state who knew, you know, who know how to create the conditions of privacy.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to our list. So number one was preserving cash and checks. Number two was state bank. Number three, protection of financial integrity. Number four, private currencies and credit cards. Number five, precious metals. Number six, direct and local investments. So let's get to number seven, which is the, I would say, playing hardball number, and that's doing business with the state. So a state can use the Secretary of State's authority to grant or restrict licenses to do business, either as a domestic or foreign corporation. So if you don't meet certain criteria, they can say you can't do business here. Mm-hmm. You know, so you were saying if you haven't incorporated the Bill of Rights
yep.
into your corporate bylaws, you can't do business.
You can't do business. That's right. Right.
So one of the things we've seen is companies engage, you know, in massive fraud. So Pfizer, biggest fine ever for essentially fraud in marketing, $2.3 billion. That's before the pandemic started. Why mm-hmm. are they allowed to do business in a state?
Right.
I mean, yeah. So we're watching. I just posted a video about one of the big retail stores, Dollar General. Mm-hmm. And the accusation is that they are putting on the shelf one price, but then when you check out, it's another. And they are doing it systematically, intentionally, all over the country is the allegation. And they are paying fines for doing this. They're being caught doing it. They are paying fines for doing it. But they're making so much money from it that they just keep doing it. In other words, the fines, it's economic to engage in this kind of activity and pay the fines because it's very profitable.
I've begun to really see Dollar General as like a criminal organization.
You're stealing from my community. And I think they're very aware of it.
It's a classic bait and switch.
Somebody at the top is making a lot of money.
Go for a drive in any American county, and you'll likely soon pass by the yellow and black lettering of a Dollar General. Drive a little further, and another will appear. Then another, then another.
Here's the other Dollar General store. It's 7 miles from the last Dollar General store we were at.
With nearly 20,000 Dollar General stores in 48 states, the Tennessee-based discount chain has sunk its teeth into lower-income, rural, and suburban areas everywhere.
It's easy to look at the dollar stores and think they are a sign of economic distress or a symptom of economic distress, but what we found is that they're in fact a cause of it.
Underneath Dollar General's so-called low everyday prices in convenient locations lies a sinister business model. And a massive scandal that hardly anybody knows about.
If you have designed a business where you are deliberately understaffing your stores, you're deliberately cutting costs, you're going to end up having these kinds of, you know, widespread mistakes in pricing. I mean, that's just the reality of you are not actually providing enough labor to comply with the law and make sure that people are getting charged what the price actually is.
Now, I will tell you, I have dealt with so much of that behavior with the car rental companies
yep.
and the hotel companies, and it's frightening. You agree to one price, you show up, it's a different price. You check out, suddenly the bill is padded. Or you bring the car back and suddenly the bill is padded with things you were never told about. And I went through a car rental process where they padded the bill when I showed up. They didn't have the car when I showed up. They padded the bill when I checked out. And I'm convinced from watching how they've done this over a series of different incidents that they have their software set up to figure out, okay, well, Joseph's time is worth X dollars per hour. And as long as we pad this, you know, below a certain amount and they calculate it per person, he won't complain because he doesn't, it's too expensive for him to complain given the value of his
right.
time.
Right.
And it's specifically designed. If you check out and say, well, what are these charges? The person at the desk will say, I don't know. This is done by a third party billing company. You have to call them. And yep. so you can systematically organize a fraudulent marketing you know, yep. before, during, and after, and do it in a way that your staff is helpless and they don't have to believe that they're engaging in fraud because they're not. They're helpless. They can't explain what the charges are.
Right.
They can't take them on or off.
Right.
And they're just helpless. And it's a plan.
Yes, I agree. I absolutely agree.
Right. And it's a plan. You know, I hate to say this. It is part of a mass atrocity.
Yeah.
I now have stories with the Dollar General video of four corporations that I've personally experienced doing this.
This padding, yes.
Right. And so I'm seeing a pattern whereby a decision has been made at the highest levels to run things this way. and to run things purposefully outside the law. And it's, you know, this is a business model and it's a decision and it's a model that's liquidating the population financially. Yes. So you're liquidating the middle class and you're doing it purposefully and intentionally, and you know it. And, you know, one of the things I've seen reporting from people with medical practices is, you know, doctors who have to, when you sign up to, you know, come in and be a patient, you have to agree that you're responsible to pay the bill, whether your insurance company pays it or not.
Right.
And then the doctor agrees to collect the insurance company, even though they've approved the procedure, refuses to pay and drags their feet. So then the doctor has to go to the patient. And essentially what is being done, if you look at the business model, mm-hmm. it's insurance fraud.
Yes.
They're selling you insurance saying they cover things when in fact they don't.
They don't.
And right. what they do is they try to make the system complicated between you and your doctor so that you don't understand you're dealing with a fraud. You're paying right. for insurance you're never going to get.
Right. It's off the charts. And in that business model, I think it's important for people to understand that what you're saying is if they are deliberately able to pad a bill, any bill, if they're able to do that and tailor it to an individual, you know, your bill might be padded a lot more for a rental car than my bill for the same rental car because we're different people. If they're doing this, they have to be doing this with AI or a computer algorithm that's going to track right. all this.
Well, they're absolutely padding the bills and misrepresenting. So they're absolutely padding the bills. They're misrepresenting the costs. They're misrepresenting yep. the service. It was really funny when I showed up to pick up my car in Memphis, they said, oh, well, we don't have any cars. And I said, well, you know, you're going to find one because I'm going to stand here until you do. And it took 2 hours and, you know, I had plenty of work to do. But when I delivered the car back on schedule, on time, on budget, on a schedule, they were telling another family they had no car for them. And this family had flown in from Latin America. And they were telling them they just had to sit there and wait. It might be a day. It might be 2 days. They didn't know.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Oh, no. It was unbelievable. But the person at the desk could say, I have no control. I have no knowledge. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm not responsible. Yeah. I know.
We remember the line, I know nothing. I know nothing. Yeah. I know nothing. Because anyway, but so I think I'm seeing a radical escalation of this over the last
yes.
couple months. And yes. it could just be I'm back in America. You certainly don't. I experienced nothing like this in Europe yet. But this is happening, and it's happening with enough companies in enough places. And I'm getting enough reporters from subscribers. Now, it's my supposition that it's custom designed for each person.
Yes.
But I don't know that. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just looking at the patterns. But I've seen it with enough companies and I've had enough reports from cross industries that I think I want the subscribers listening to this to start organizing their lives around the understanding that companies behave this way.
Yes, absolutely. And,
right. And so when you look at a price on the shelf, you need to check your receipt to make sure it's the price on the receipt, and you need to raise a stink. Another reason to pay cash. And you need to know that if companies are behaving like this, you need to avoid them.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to, you know, we're going to have to find a way to proactively understand who can be trusted and who can't. The market's going to have to differentiate. Anyway, so, but states can also, and I think the big one for states is, who is the state buying from? Who is the state doing contracts with?
Yes.
Who is the state giving their banking business?
Yes.
Who is the state appointing as their agent or underwriter or investment advisor? States give out huge amounts of contracts in business.
Right.
And you know, if the states are hiring and paying people who defraud their residents, there's a multiple personality disorder there that needs yep. to be worked out.
Yep.
Another one is, what are the permitted investments in state reserves, deposits, and pension funds? Are you actively steering money into the corporations that behave the worst. I'll never forget looking at CalPERS and CalSTRS and realizing that CalSTRS had dramatically increased the amount of money they were putting in private equity firms.
Well, the
private equity firms are the ones that are buying companies and getting them to behave this way. Our pension funds are financing the worst disaster capitalism in the world.
Yeah, Texas recently, if I'm not mistaken, severed its state relationship with a major hedge fund, and I forget which one it was, but
I think it was severing. You know, you have states pulling money from BlackRock because of the ESG.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
And that's because of ESG. Okay, so there's a lot more. There's also the choice of state law clauses. So when you enter into a contract or purchase a product, are you insisting that state law have jurisdiction? You know, when you click on those terms and conditions, there is a lot states can do to manage. You know, I would love to see more states manage their money in-house. So we saw Harvard delegate its management to out-of-house. And as a result, you know, theoretically, many more shenanigans can go on as a result without the in-house state. I think the states having in-house capacity to manage their own money, whether it's the banking business or the underwriting, I think we're being penny-wise, pound-foolish. We need the intellectual mastery in-house. Okay, well, that's seven, doing business with states. So there's a wide number. You know, I'll never forget, remember, I don't know if you remember this, but Rumsfeld saying, you know, that he thought sex slave trafficking was terrible and having it pointed out, you know, he was just he and the U.S. government were just handing out new contracts to the people who had just been indicted for sex slave trafficking, you know, so really? I know nothing.
I know.
Okay. So number eight is taxation. Of course, one of the things that draws people to Tennessee is they've steadily worked at lowering taxes. But obviously tax policy and how you manage tax policy is a big one. One you and I have talked a lot about is whether or not states can start. I'd love to see states create escrows for federal taxes.
Here. And Catherine, you were talking about, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you were talking about this last night at your Solaria gathering. And as you were outlining what you want to do, and I know that you want to do that, and I want you to do that, but I was thinking as you were outlining it that once one state takes the plunge, and you even made a point of mentioning this very point in connection with another idea, the WHO and Louisiana. But once one state bites the bullet and sets up what you want to set up, it is going to spread like wildfire. And it needs to.
Well, but I do think this is a one that needs to be set up with care. So the first one that does it.
Yes, right. Absolutely.
The first one that does it, this is a tricky design to work out and get done and make sure it's lawful.
Right.
What I would love to see is essentially a state attorney general agree to represent the citizens who choose to do so. You know, this is voluntary to the citizens. But if a citizen says, I want to pay my federal tax money into an escrow and have the attorney general represent me because my money is being spent illegally.
Right.
And the U.S. government is failing. One, they're failing to obey the financial management laws. Two, there's not full and fair disclosure of how my money is being spent. But I can see just from what's going on in the world, the money is being spent illegally.
Right.
So we have the federal government operating outside the law. I, as a citizen, am responsible to ensure that money is spent according to the Constitution and financial management laws, and I choose to allow the AG to represent me. Now, I had first proposed this in connection with a situation where the federal government had abrogated its obligations to the citizens by instituting a CBDC and digital ID control system, or by abrogating its obligations to pay a variety of different payments owed to citizens within
right.
the state.
Right.
So I had listed nine, you know, areas of essentially default by the federal government that would kick in a provision for the AG, if he chose to do so, and the citizens, if they chose to do so, to participate right. in an escrow. And right. and here's the problem, Joseph. You know, the pension funds, the state pension funds, are buying treasury securities, and then the money is disappearing out the back yes. door, being spent illegally. Yes. And the citizens are paying taxes, and then the money is disappearing out the back door and being spent illegally. And that's a problem, because it's the citizens who are liable for those bonds that have now been issued,
right.
and the assets have disappeared into private hands out the back door. And it is this game that is the number one source of inequality in America.
Yep, absolutely. Here, here.
And everyone says, oh, it's too big for me to deal with. Well, I have news for you. It's not too big for me to deal with, because right. what is relevant is what solves the problem.
Yes.
If we have, you know, I don't know if you remember that cover where we had the cow with the map of the world in his,
yes, I painted do.
On his, in it on his, you know, his markings, and the farmer's milking the cow, and there's a hole in the bucket, and it's going downstairs to all these, yep. you know, there's a hole in the treasury. And if all of our money is going in and disappearing out of the hole, there's no solutions. So this is not too big for me to deal with. I'm happy to deal with this, because this is what solves the problem.
Yep.
We, you know, when you bring transparency to it, and then you start to act. And I think the other thing is, if you create this escrow, one of the powers that the AG can exercise is asserting common law right of offsets. Because people say, oh, well, we can't get that money back. Yes, we can. Mm-hmm. You can get that money back by asserting a common law right of offset. And I've told the story of how I did it. So I have clawed back $14,000 from mm-hmm. one of the New York Fed member banks for basically engaging in illegal transactions. So anyway, so there is a lot that can be done on taxation, and we're going to have to face that. As big or overwhelming as it seems, because you cannot spend money on criminal enterprise endlessly, because if you do, what you're going to get is criminal enterprise. So the criminal enterprise just keeps growing.
Yeah. It's time to make it stop growing.
Right.
It's time.
Okay. So number nine, and connected to some of the ones we've covered, is protecting against a land grab. And we're going to talk about it in the top 10 stories. But one of the great pushbacks in the first quarter was when the AGs and the, starting with the treasurers and the wonderful treasurer from Utah, Marlo Oaks, leading a push against the New York Stock Exchange and the SEC creating something called natural asset companies, which if you thought we had, you know, as Charlie Stevens said, if you thought the rackets were bad, wait till you see next. But I'm very concerned. One of the reasons it's so important to have financial transaction liquidity is if you shut off that liquidity, then it's very easy to force citizens to sell their land and to sell their land cheap. And to a certain extent, that's what we're watching now. We're seeing inflation pushing people to sell their homes, and all the big investors showing up with cash, or many of the big investors showing up with cash and buying, you know, properties are flying out the door for cash. So anyway, so any action we can take to protect against freezing of liquidity or bank runs and consolidations, you know, so if we see what happened to SVB happening all across the country, that's what happened during the Depression.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You got runs on banks, shutting down banks, cutting off liquidity, and suddenly everybody still has their mortgage.
Yep.
So one of the bills we grappled with in Tennessee was, how do we do a moratorium on mortgage foreclosures in a situation where the Federal Reserve is running the banks intentionally and the federal government is cutting off income?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, that's just another argument for a sovereign state bank.
Right.
It really is.
Right. We're also seeing limits, and I haven't seen this in Tennessee, but efforts around the country to limit institutional investment in residential homes and limit foreign land purchases and ownership. So, you know, if you have Bill Gates coming in and buying up all your farmland, or the Chinese coming up and buying all your farmland and agricultural companies, you know, that's going to turn into a political issue.
I'm wondering if this is connected to something else that I encountered years ago, and I want to talk to you about this off the air, but there's something else that might be in play here with these natural asset companies. Right. But I'll talk to you about it off the air. It may be another one of my harebrained ideas that goes nowhere. So,
There's high octane speculation, but then there's
harebrained ideas.
They're harebrained ideas, and some of those have to happen offline.
Okay. Offline, that's right.
So number 9 was protecting against the land grab. Number 10 is constitutional protections. And this gets back to stopping the tyranny. And we see, you know, and this is where we really feel the debate between the feds making it financially attractive to behave in ways which are outside the Constitution.
Right.
So the classic example now after the pandemic is paying hospitals to give people drugs which kill them.
Right.
You know, so that, you know, that's a perfect, but we see tremendous activity around the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're waiting for the decision in Murphy versus Missouri. Very scary discussion at the Supreme Court on this excellent lawsuit brought by Missouri and Louisiana. And I didn't realize this, but the fellow who was supposed to argue the case for Louisiana had a skiing accident the week before and was in a wheelchair. And of the challenges, I think it was, I'm not clear who argued it on his behalf, but can you imagine you're supposed to argue in front of the Supreme Court and your team gets bollocksed up with?
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised.
And I would not be surprised if it was not an accident.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
The number of bills in Tennessee impacting the Second Amendment are unbelievable. And the amount of money, and I'll just say his name, Michael Bloomberg is spending God knows how much money to overwhelm at least my state with AstroTurf and activists and everything else. And all I can tell you is the reason I'm sure that faction is absolutely intent on a land grab is it's a direct relationship to how much money Michael Bloomberg will spend to bring in the guns.
Well, the two are definitely connected. Think Bundy Ranch, folks.
The thing. If you look at if you look at all the criminal behavior that has been engaged in to push people off their land and to bankrupt the middle class, I mean, it's just outright criminal. And I think, you know, I'm back to Kunstler's wonderful framing of the situation. It's the sane versus the insane.
Yes.
And at some point, the sane are going to say, no, you're not going to come take my land. One of the things Representative Halsey did in Tennessee was he engineered he had a bill passed that said we could pay our property taxes forward. Because one way they get you off the land is, you know, they cut your income, but you still got your mortgage. But if you've paid off your mortgage, another way, you know, if I've paid my property taxes several years forward, that gives me breathing room.
Yep.
So I thought that was a wonderful thing to do.
Yep.
Another thing is he got a bill passed saying municipalities don't have to enforce international organizations and their sustainable development goals or all these other things.
Here.
Right. And we've also seen laws stop, you know, trying to stop the digital ID. Yep. And then, of course, there's the whole area of nullification. So there's a lot going on in this area. And I think the big one, Joseph, is where is the constituency to support their legislators just saying no to the federal money? You have to just say no.
Catherine, this, to me, all of this goes back to a fundamental principle here that needs to be reiterated. And I'm going to put it very bluntly. Abraham Lincoln was wrong. The Union is not a suicide pact.
Right.
There is no way to explain why states would want to enter an arrangement or a marriage they can't get out of. So nullification, yeah, you better believe that that is a crucial principle of our Constitution. I mean,
right.
And these states that are doing this, they deserve our support. I really think it's going to come down. There's going to be some sort of Dred Scott decision on the part of the nutcases in the Supreme Court. That's going to be just plain wrong once again. And states have to realize that at that point, they have to step up to the plate. That's just the bottom line. And
well, here's the thing. I see a tremendous number of legislatures who are willing to step up to the plate.
Yeah.
They need their constituents to support them.
Support them. Right.
So where are the constituencies that will step up to the plate? Because, I don't want to hear, I want my state legislators to fight for freedom. But, I want to take the check and sell them down the river over the red button problem.
Right. Right.
So I think the time has come to look in the mirror and say, are you going to be for financial freedom personally? And are you going to do the things that make financial freedom happen? Or are you going to be a slave? It's your decision.
Right.
But I have to tell you, I see the leadership in place. I want to see the constituencies support them.
I agree.
I
agree. It may be literally a matter of having to give up a government check in order to show the support.
I don't see yet that, yes, I see the need in things like education.
Right. Exactly.
But I think step number one is understanding, getting a critical mass of, say, 5% of the population to understand that the control grid is really this bad.
Yes.
And you're talking about something coming, which is you're not going to be governed by the insane. You're going to be controlled by the insane.
Yep.
Now, since the financial coup started, we've been governed by the insane. But there's a difference between being governed by the insane and being controlled directly one-on-one by them with centralized technology.
Right.
So right. Each one of us has to say, okay, I have a problem and I'm going to take responsibility for that problem. If you can get 5% to see the problem and take responsibility, then we're off to the races because that's all you need. You need 5% supporting the leadership. Anyway, so think about what you can do to build a constituency of that 5% to help the, and for heaven's sakes, get to know your state legislator. Okay, so number 10, constitutional protections. Again, a wealth at the website for you to explore and discover. Number 11 is food and health freedom. And I wanted to mention food and health freedom because I am shocked to see some of the wars going on in the food space. We had the group, Weston Price and their group, was trying to get a bill passed in the Tennessee legislature that in a pandemic situation, you cannot mandate small farms that do not sell out beef out of state to inject their cattle with mRNA vaccines.
Yep.
So all we're saying is that farms with 30 cattle or less who don't market out of state, don't have to poison their livestock and poison our food supply.
Yep. Hear, hear.
And the tsunami of food organizations and business lobbies oppose that bill were enough to drive it, from not getting out of committee.
I can believe it.
I mean, well, but what you're looking at is an enormous constituency dedicated to poisoning our meat supply.
Yep. Yeah.
And And that's why I say, if you want fresh food, you are personally going to have to organize with people locally and figure out how you're going to get it.
Yep.
And it is not unrelated to your Second Amendment rights, because you're going to have to get it and you're going to have to protect it.
And it's not unrelated to cash. Got to be able to pay cash for it.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. So much food and health is a whole area that we're not doing in this wrap up. And we have a wealth at the food series at Soleri, but food and health is important. And it's not surprising you see the legislators who are great at financial freedom, you know, are great at food and health. The other thing I'm seeing, which is wonderful, is enormous cooperation between the food and health groups. The food and health groups have a lot of deep knowledge and experience working at the state legislature, and they are very cooperative and willing to team up and work with financial freedom. They see that food and health and financial freedom are intimately involved. The financial people don't yet understand the possibilities and opportunities to cooperate cross-sector.
Right.
And we need to get the bankers and the food and health people somehow swarming together. That's one of my goals. Okay, our category number 12 is other. And other includes a few things. One is states are struggling under massive uneconomic federal regulation. And one of the things they're suffering under is, I had a wonderful dinner with a great banker the other day, and he said, you know, the problem is not that the big banks are coming and buying up the small banks. He said, it's always been that way. The problem is new banks aren't being created because the federal regulations are so burdensome.
Right.
That's a problem, because the health of our economy depends on lots and lots of banks.
Yeah.
And lots of good community banks and credit unions. Richard Werner's piece shows that the more great local banks and credit unions you have that are doing productive lending, you can have massive growth with no inflation.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
When you have the kind of monetary and fiscal policies we have now, you get great inflation. But it is possible to dramatically increase economic activity at the local level without getting inflation.
Yeah.
So another reason I'd love to see a great state bank is they could start to grapple with, okay, what can we do to protect, you know, local banks and state banks from the burden of federal regulation? And they can have that kind of intellectual capacity can help to push back. Another thing I'm very concerned about is we have seen decades and decades of federal funding of infrastructure which cannot be economically maintained by the private economy in a place.
Yes.
And so it's like an addiction to a drug. And, you know, now you need more federal money just to maintain this stuff.
Yes.
And Chuck Marone, we had a great interview with Chuck Marone on the Soleri Report. And he said, you know, my concern is Detroit is just first. A lot of places all around the country are going to have to just let go and not maintain stuff.
Yeah.
And that's not good, because then you're talking about roads falling down, bridges falling down. You know, this is a tricky business.
I can attest to that from personal experience, because, you know, you drove into town, you've been over here to what the locals are calling Stonehenge, this massive interchange where you see all these bridge pylons. And no bridges on them. You know, they did this about 3 years ago. They took down that bridge that I pointed out to you a couple of times. It literally looked like it was going to collapse. Unfortunately, they finally took it out. But the infrastructure around here is crumbling because there's not enough to support it. You know, you can see it.
The reason I love market economies is they don't build out beyond their capacity.
Right.
You flow in this money like federal financial methadone. And then you build out beyond your capacity, and then you get a mess.
Yeah. And the other thing I think that this little local example illustrates is, again, I don't think it's for want of money or for want of the labor to finish this project, or even, you know, for whatever land they may need to buy or whatever easements or whatever. I think it's a lack of local capital to sustain it. There's so much capital here that could take care of that whole intersection over here, but it's got to go to the federal government, and they've got to, you know, they've got to pass their bills and have a little bit trickle back to us. And it's just not working, Catherine.
Well, it's interesting. I bet you if the local government or the state government, this is the Guernsey Island story, issued script to build it, you know, people would accept the script, and then, you know, but then you'd have a political war.
Or, right? Or your idea about direct and local investment.
Right.
If the locals here could go and the state wanted to float a bond to finish this interchange, it would be done by now. It's just ridiculous what we're seeing happen. Ridiculous.
Right. So, and there are many unanswered questions, you know, but they all come back to the simple question of, are we going to be controlled by people who can print money out of thin air?
Exactly.
And
insane,
are we gonna be
people.
Insane people.
Yeah.
So, well, actually, I've found the ones who print the money are pretty sane. The ones who direct them what to do and use the money.
Right.
So there's a broad range of other issues, but I think the reason I love this sane versus insane framework is it's very important to look at them on an integrated basis and say, look, at the root, this is simple. We are centralizing in an uneconomic way.
Yep.
It is delivering control to a small group of people, which advantage them.
Yep.
But it shrinks the pie. It's a wealth destroying process.
Yep.
And it delivers central control. It is not an economic model. It is a coup d'etat.
Yes.
It is a fundamental change of government.
Yes.
And each one of us needs to decide, are we going to go along with it? Are we going to go with the flow? Or are we going to say no? And if we want to say no, the good news is, that if you can stop the centralization or the uneconomic portion of the centralization, and you can do a building wealth reset, the world can work.
Yeah,
the sane can run the world, and the sane can create a lot more wealth than the insane. The insane are very good at stealing wealth. They're not good at creating wealth. Right.
They're good at stealing wealth, and they're not good at anything else. Wealth or otherwise.
I think they are. I think when it comes to spinning lies and the media and the PR and the mic, I mean, I think these guys are fabulous at mind control.
Well, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I have a lot of respect for their ability in certain areas. I mean, it's very demonic, but it's very.
Well, it's ability, but they're also under their own mind control. That's the other problem. You know, this is why they're insane, but. Yeah, I take your point, but
well, but if they're so stupid, how come they keep pulling the rabbit out of the hat? Do you know what I mean? I think the time has come when, you know. So I recognize their talents and their ability in certain areas. I do. I think they're very good at what they do. And if you look at many of the people in the system who I often hear are stupid, I know they're not stupid. They're in a prisoner's dilemma. The crowd votes for the criminals. The crowd will not support, you know, the crowd will not support the honest, you know, I work with leaders who are fighting for freedom every day. They are nowhere near as supported as the bad guys.
Oh, I'm sure. I saw a meme recently of a picture of Pontius Pilate pointing to Christ, and you know, he's addressing a crowd of people, and underneath the picture, it said 2,000 years later, and the people are still choosing the criminals.
There you go.
So okay. You're right on that.
Right. So I think the time has come. I just saw Wandering Earth 2. I love watching these big epic space dramas, and there's this wonderful scene where the guy who's basically envisioning that we can move the Earth out of the solar system to save the human race, he says, in a time of crisis, there is only responsibility. Mm-hmm. Right. True. So that's my message. Okay. So that's an overview of our theme. And again, go to the website. There's a wealth of resources. And we're going to be continuing to track this because I believe that the state stepping up and establishing the conditions of sovereignty has just begun. This is a process that's going to go on for years and years and years. And you want to be part of it, because I will tell you, the people who are working on this are the people, as I drive across the country, these are the people who are having the most fun. You know, you want to be part of the solution, because that's where the fun is having. Okay, so let's turn to the top 10 stories. And this really says, okay, in the first quarter, what happened that was really important? And as usual, we have the stories organized with headlines in each. We sort of picked out the important headlines, and we'll go through some and all. And we've also integrated the top videos within the stories. And anyway, so check out the news, trends, and stories section of the wrap-up. And I'm on part one, top stories. So number one story, you ready, Joseph?
I'm ready.
Okay. The feds weaponized the financial system. I don't know if you saw the report from, you know, there's this Jim Jordan's committee, the Weaponization of Government Committee. And they came out with a report of Bank of America and the FBI, or included the story of basically Bank of America working with the FBI to help them basically falsify cases against Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, they're actively working and soliciting. Bank of America is actively working and soliciting with the FBI to basically, you know, invade Americans' privacy without a court order or warrant, and basically come up with a way of trying to frame them for this ridiculous. I mean, it just, you just can't. You almost want to say it can't get any worse than that, but
it doesn't surprise me. You're dealing with a lawless system, and why the FBI? Well, the FBI has been corrupt since J. Edgar Hoover. You know, that's the bottom line. That has been a corrupt outfit ever since its inception. I'm not surprised.
Well, you know, I do have to say, as I always do, that in my litigation with the federal government, the FBI were the good guys.
Really?
They were great. They were great. We would FOIA them, and they would give us documents saying, you know, we audited it. You know, we did an investigation. These people are entirely clean. There's nothing wrong going on here. And then we turn it into the court, and the judge, you know, is the former head of the general counsel of the CIA, would get furious. And you could tell they were going to call and yell that. Well, I had so many good experiences with the FBI. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
I had one FBI IT guy come and said, how can you deal with these horrible HUD people? He gave me his card and said, you know, when this is over, I'd love to come work for you. Anyway, so you know, I seem to be the one exception, but there is no doubt one of the top stories that we have in this section is the, I don't know if you remember the FBI seizing the safe deposit boxes out in California. They needed to seize one box for, they were doing an investigation. I think it was money laundering. I don't remember the details. But they decided to seize all the boxes at the same custodian, which is outrageous.
Yep.
Anyway, the federal court, you know, ruled against them finally. So everybody took them to court, and finally the court pointed out, no, you can't do that, FBI. Anyway, so that was one of the things that happened. We have SWIFT announcing that they're going to launch a new central bank digital currency platform in 12 to 24 months was another story. Yep. And we had Yellen, there was one interview last year, famous in 2023, Yellen announced, the person interviewing her was saying, how can we afford a war both in the Middle East and in the Ukraine? And Yellen said, well, you know, the American people owe us $7 trillion in taxes, and we're going to collect. And one of the stories this quarter was IRS rakes in record $4.9 trillion in taxes from Americans amid enforcement crackdown.
Unreal.
And then another, agent admits IRS spies with AI target small people.
I can believe that.
And it gets even better. The IRS has now offered an e-file program where you can, instead of doing your taxes on TurboTax software, you can do it on the IRS's website and send them the money directly.
Oh, yeah. I trust them and their software.
Anyway, so You know, this is why I come back to, you know, I love digital systems, but the digital systems are being used to engineer more and more invasive control.
Control. Yeah.
And unfortunately, what we're watching in these stories is the feds are not obeying the law. They're not obeying the law. Right. So they're not obeying the financial management laws related to how they deal with taxpayers' money, but they're not obeying the enforcement laws. And unfortunately, my concern, we just saw Garland set up a new center to sort of target and track extremists. And we have a teammate at Solari who loves to shop at the big hunting stores. Mm-hmm. So Orvis, Cabello's, Dick Pro Shop. And apparently in this extremist center, one thing that targets you or defines you as an extremist is if you shop at these stores.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So if you love Orvis.
So they're saying if you attend the Catholic Latin Mass or shop at sports goods stores.
Well, it's, you know, here's the thing. It's a huge job program to look for enemies. And you know, I hate to say it. They can't find terrorists. So, you know, they've got to create them, I guess.
They're letting them in by the thousands on the southern border. What do you mean they can't find any?
Oh, no, they're not, I disagree, Joseph. They are not letting them in. They are financing them coming from all around the world to arrive.
That's a much more accurate way of putting it.
Then they are financing them to come across the border, and then they are financing them to come into your community.
Yeah.
Right. So we're going to get to the immigration question, but what can I say? You're right. They are financing terrorists coming across the border. So I don't know if you remember, one of the big stories was, do you remember Christopher Wray gave a briefing to sheriffs who'd come in to Washington and warned them that terrorists were coming across the border. And the sheriff came back and did a press release, a press conference, and warned the citizens, you know, your sheriffs need help because we have terrorists coming across the border. And I have this wonderful ally in Tennessee who's smart as a whip, and I just adore. But he immediately went into alpha male mode of, oh, we've got to organize to protect against the terrorists. And I said to him, what are you thinking? Christopher Wray works for President Biden, who works for the central bankers who are financing all these people coming to the border. They're financing them coming across the border. You know, I gave him a whole speech and I said, why are you getting sucked into this? This is you're being played. Yep. Why are you doing this? I said, don't you understand the only foreign boogeyman you need to worry about, the only terrorist you need to worry about is at 33 Liberty Street in New York. Who do you think's doing this? Anyway, but I don't know why I'm still struggling to get people to see the enemy.
Well, I think a part of it, Catherine, is people are naturally inclined to look for one all-encompassing enemy. My problem is the central banksters, when they're bringing in terrorists, it's going to be the same problem that they had when they put Adolf Hitler into power. Because the people they're playing around with will take their money and obey them to a certain point. But at a certain other point, no. They will lose control of this situation eventually. Because they're dealing with people equally evil, equally insane, and not afraid to go after them as well. That's the problem. We're dealing with the mafia.
So one of the reasons I love to do the Solari meet and greet is the Solari subscribers are they're defined by their willingness to take responsibility. These are people who take responsibility. And they take responsibility to not only understand their world, but to live a productive life and try and be ethical in the midst of an unethical society. But having been in America now since January, you know, I am stunned at the corruption. And I don't mean corruption just from corporations. I'm not just talking about corruption from corporations or corruption from the federal government. I'm talking at corruption at every level of society.
I know.
So
I know.
So there was one video I watched of someone had been in a Boeing plant, and he had interviewed, and the Boeing plant, I think it was for the Dreamliner, had 15 engineers in the engineering department, and he interviewed all of them. And 10 of them said that they would never fly in a Dreamliner plane. They didn't think it was safe.
Yep.
And 5 said they would, and one of them said he would because he's suicidal. He made a joke. But all 15 were willing to go to work and make planes that they thought weren't safe and take a check and get paid for that.
Yes.
This is a Boeing factory in the U.S. state of South Carolina. Workers here in Charleston are assembling the company's flagship product, the 787 Dreamliner. But this footage reveals some have little faith in the plane they build.
Do you fly on one?
No.
You won't fly on one. Did you fly on one of these planes?
Of 15 workers asked randomly, 10 said they would not fly on the Dreamliner.
I wouldn't fly one of these planes because I see the quality of the other going down around here.
An employee captured the footage after contacting Al Jazeera to tell us he had serious concerns about what he was seeing. At his request, we changed his voice.
With all the problems reported on the 787, there's 90% that's getting swept away, hushed up. It's an iceberg.
In another meeting, the source told us workers are often underskilled, uncaring, and in some cases on drugs.
I've seen a lot of things that should not go on at an airplane plant. People talking about doing drugs, looking for drugs.
It's all coke and painkillers. You can get weed here. It's really good weed here.
They don't drug test nobody.
I know they don't.
There's people who go out there and want to go smoke one up.
Do they?
Hell yeah.
So that wasn't Boeing's board. That wasn't Boeing's CEO. That was 15 engineers who personally were willing to kill for money.
I know.
Yeah. When you build a plane that's not safe and you ship it and you do nothing, and people die, you are responsible.
Yes.
You did that. Yes. You did that. There's no, I appreciate the leadership doing everything they can to get these systems to run where we can say we know nothing and we're not responsible. But in my world, I'm a Christian, each one of us is responsible for our actions.
Yes, I agree.
And the corruption is not just at the top. The corruption is unbelievably widespread.
I know.
And that has to be faced if we're going to change. If you want the state legislatures to be able to create the condition of sovereignty, then you as an individual and your neighbors as an individual and your family as individuals have to be responsible to create the conditions of sovereignty.
Yeah, I agree.
Right. So we cannot say, I'm not going to push the red button and I'm going to take the check and I'm going to pretend I'm good and think it's okay or it's going to work for you in the long run. It's not. So we're coming down to a fight that's for all the marbles and you've got to decide which side you're on. This is a coup. Are you for the coup or against the coup? And if you're against the coup, then you better wake up and clean up your own act. That's what I'm saying. So
I agree. Totally.
Right.
Totally.
Do we think Catherine can ever get off the soapbox? Oh my God. Well, it's very
funny. No, you know, stay on the soapbox because people need to hear it.
Well, you know, it's funny because Mike Rupert once said that he'd seen 25 examples of black budget litigation, and I was the only person who ever won one. So, you know, the word was he couldn't win one, but I won one. And one of the reasons I won one is because everybody trusted me. It was amazing how many people in government, you know, the FBI, at HUD, at the DC government, all throughout government, who would not do dirty against us and protected us and helped us. And it was because they trusted us. And it was extraordinary. It taught me that law matters. Yes. But it only law matters, but law will only work for you if you obey it.
Right.
You have to be worthy of the law to take advantage of the law. But it does work, even when you're dealing with the insane. So story number two, Congress fails while the states grapple with their new roles. Congress is defined, Joseph, by a couple of extraordinary people who are doing a great, a great job. But aside from those wonderful people, it is so bad.
Yes.
Every year Congress votes out more appropriations for more horrible things.
Yes.
Despite the fact that all the money is managed illegally.
Yeah.
They just keep shoveling it out.
Yeah.
I think the question is, how much longer will Congress exist? I mean,
good question.
Right.
And the reason I say that, Catherine, is in a certain sense, it's become so corrupt. It's one vast irrelevancy. That's why I think you're seeing the states stepping up like they are, because, Congress is so corrupt. I think there's some sort of perception that's been growing in the country that it's so corrupt that people are trying to find ways to work around it and not have to deal with it. I don't know how else to put it.
So I was up for a meeting late last year with one of the senators.
Yes.
And he was working on pushing back on the vaccine issue, which is not, and he was warning us that it's not politically popular. So I said to him, Senator, why are you doing this? What you're doing is very courageous. And he looked at me, he said, I didn't want to come back last time, but they voted me in anyway. He said, I don't care if they vote me out. He said, you have no idea how dysfunctional this place is. He said, I couldn't care less if they vote me out. I'm just going to do what's right, and I don't care. And it was remarkable because I've had several people in Congress tell me, or people very close to them tell me, that they're going to leave and run for state office because...
I can believe it.
Right. They want to get something done. Right.
Yeah, I can believe it. Because, I share that opinion. I'm to the point, why bother with Congress? They're not going to get anything done. It's just so corrupt.
On the NAC Act, it really helped what they did. And we'll get to that when we talk about NACs. But the other thing, the one I want to highlight here, and we have great headlines at the website, is we have Louisiana just pass a bill. And they were the first. So big kudos to Louisiana. They passed a bill that denies any communication from the WHO, UN, and WEF may be used for a basis for action within the state.
Good for them.
Right.
And good for them.
This is so Louisiana is saying no to the WHO because Congress won't.
Right.
So Congress failed, and now Louisiana is doing it. And as I said last night, that's the advantage of having French law.
They've read John Calhoun in Louisiana. That's the other part of this. He was a big one for nullification. And, if you want to read that aspect of legal history, go read some John C. Calhoun. I agree with you. Kudos to Louisiana.
Another thing that happened in the first quarter that's gotten a lot of attention is both New Hampshire and Tennessee submitted bills meant or designed to ban chemtrails over the state. Now, the states don't have real enforcement capacity. But I will say one thing. One enforcement could be a tax escrow.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So, I would do a tax escrow over financial integrity and financial freedom. But, if it's geoengineering, I'll take it. Anyway, one of the things I was talking to somebody in Tennessee, and they just had testimony, and apparently you're going to laugh, Joseph. Some guy from California came to testify against the bill because he said it would interrupt his cloud seeding business. And apparently he came and testified and was testifying about, you know, why he didn't want this, because he wanted to be able to do his cloud seeding business. But apparently several legislators commented later that they thought this was all a theory, you know, that this stuff wasn't really happening. And this guy talking about what he was doing in his business, they realized, oh, my God,
this is really
yeah, weather modification and aerosol injection into the stratosphere is really happening. You know, it's, and they were like, oh, my God.
Catherine, it was real for me when I was a kid in South Dakota. You remember the Rapid City flood in 1973 or four?
Right.
It, the state of South Dakota at that time had a weather a state weather modification bureau. You could go look it up.
Right.
And after that flood occurred in Rapid City, you know, this was all the talk in the state was, you know, this was the result of the cloud seeding that had taken place a couple of days before. So, you know, it is absolutely real, folks.
So I'll never forget Skidmore, you know, Skidmore came to me and he said, do you think this is possibly real? This is many years ago. And I said, Mark, Beijing just announced that there will be no problem with the weather during the Olympics because they'll fix it.
Yeah.
And he said, well, that's ridiculous. I said, go to Wikipedia and look up the Beijing Weather Modification Office. They even have a wiki entry.
Yeah.
And he did. And he came back and he said, oh, my God, how was this all going on? And I didn't know. I said, I don't know. And then he and one of his students ended up doing a survey and building a paper that they published of all the literature on weather modification and, you know, spring.
Would they have weather derivatives if they weren't able to manipulate the weather? No, of course not.
I remember when you went ballistic when they announced the weather derivatives.
I thought, you know, what more proof do we need, you know?
Okay, so story number three is talk about good news. Here's some very good, heartwarming news. ESG, climate change, and the run on BlackRock and the Net Zero Alliance. Okay, so if there's one guy who deserves to have his head handed to him, it's Mark Carney. And Mark Carney is the Net Zero Alliance. BlackRock, of course, is the money manager who's promoted ESG. Right. So while Larry Fink is promoting the, you know, the control grid on one hand, he's talking about doing good on the other with ESG. And the states have had it. And a lot of it is because the ESG applies to climate change. And as Kunstler said, we've all figured out it's just climate change is just a cudgel you use to hit us and kill us and steal our stuff.
Yep, exactly. It's exactly so.
Right. So we saw last year, the year before, Vanguard pulls out, a whole bunch of insurance companies pull out of the Net Zero Alliance. And one of the reasons they do, Joseph, it's very interesting. I have tried to understand exactly how a company would apply these things in the trenches. You know, so how do you apply it to your office building? How do you apply it to marketing lipstick? How do you apply it? You know, what is the day-to-day implication of how you integrate this? It's impossible.
Right, right.
It's impossible. I mean, one of the reasons, so I have a screen company and I do a screen, you know, and we're looking for companies. You know, our screen is fundamentally about screening out companies that have a criminal business model.
Right.
So if you have one shelf on the price and another shelf at the register systematically, then you're not a company we want in our screen because you have a criminal business model. Right. But we're looking for companies that are not perfect. We're just looking for companies that are productive. And one of the things you learn very quickly when you do a screen like that is what you're looking for is excellence in governance and excellent in management, because management, as one of my partners would say, is led to appropriate decision making.
Right.
If you look at the details of how to market lipstick on a responsible basis, there are thousands of decisions. Things happen every day. They change every day. If you have excellence in management, they know what to do and they know how to optimize between thousands of competing, you know, issues and needs, you know, and they optimize and it's never perfect. You know, it's messy. It's organic. Right. Life is organic. Business is organic. Okay. So good management knows how to optimize and make intelligent decisions. Things go wrong, they fix it, right?
Right.
The notion that you can take, you know, what these guys were promoting and integrate it down into the details of a business, it's just a control system.
Right.
That's all it is. It's just a ya-ya control system.
Yes.
Anyway, so you are watching these businesses. Lloyd's is now the latest firm to exit from the Net Zero Alliance.
Lloyd's of London?
Lloyd's of London is out. Right. Now, it gets better. BlackRock and JP Morgan Chase have dropped out.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. No,
JP and Carrie, Morgan and Lloyd's have dropped out.
Yeah, and Carrie left the job as top U.S. climate diplomat. I'm sure he got tired of people pointing out he has many houses, many planes. You know, I think he sold his yacht.
Well, God bless him for, jeez.
Right. But the other thing is the EU farmers have made the EU back down on net zero.
Yeah.
So, Tennessee has sued BlackRock, citing misleading ESG strategy. So, you know, here's the thing. It comes back to the saying, realizing that this is just made up yaya.
Yeah, it is.
And once they realize, oh, this is just a global scam, and we're going to push back. We can't, you know, it's unworkable. What is being pushed on people is unworkable. I had a wonderful subscriber who's in the manufacturing business who was at a meet and greet earlier this last month. And they said, you know, we are being required to integrate these things. They don't work. They simply waste time and money, but we're doing them. It's almost like they have a part of their operation, which is designed to waste energy, waste time, waste money. And they do it just to please the climate change gods.
Yep. Yep.
And the Net Zero Alliance is definitely falling apart, and the climate change op. Well, ESG is falling apart. Net Zero Alliance is falling apart. And the climate change op is, you know, we are into serious trench warfare.
Right.
And it would be great to see, it would be great to see that happen. And, you know, kudos to the state treasurers again for exercising that power. Okay, story number four is state treasurers and AGs exercise their power. NACs bite the dust. So this was one of the great success stories. Kudos to the treasurer of Utah, who led 23 treasurers. And then we had Kansas and Utah AGs leading 26 AGs. To try and stop the natural asset company regulation from being implemented by the SEC and the New York Stock Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Congress jumping in with the Natural Resource Committee jumped in. And so you had this pincer movement of AGs, treasurers, and Congress. And I'd like to point out, I believe Mark Green from Tennessee was Mark Green from Tennessee and Harrod Hagman from Wyoming. The headline in the story is Fight to Protect American Lands from Foreign Adversaries and Green New Deals. Two of the people who were very instrumental to helping everyone was Margaret and Dan Byfield from American Stewards of Liberty. And we had them on Financial Rebellion several times because we wanted to keep that public.
They also tried to create something called natural asset companies, where the New York Stock Exchange would list these new companies and allow all these protected assets, so all the assets that they're trying to move out of control of the American people and into either environmentalist control or federal government's control or state or local government's control, then those could be enrolled in these natural asset companies so that the same entities pushing the climate crisis narrative and 30 by 30 would then be able to control those assets and profit from those assets. And so that's the natural asset company fight that, you know, we've thankfully were able to stop for now. And, but all these things are linked. Everything that you are watching in the financial world, you know, they're linked to our land. The land is the real asset. And they seem to really be focused on taking this right now and trying to eliminate our control, the American people's control over the natural resource base. and in the country. If they can gain control of that, they have complete control of not only our nation and our government, but of the people.
And I will tell you, if you look at the fight over conservation easements and the NAACs, it is brutal.
Brutal, I can imagine.
Brutal. And, you know, I know so many wonderful people who think conservation easements are good things, but if you look at how they're planning on using them, please, please, before you ever consider entering into a conservation easement, you know, go sign up for American Stewards of Liberty, listen to what Margaret and Dan have to say, and be very, very careful.
Yes.
Very careful.
Yeah.
Anyway, so NAACs Bite the Dust was a great success story. And it shows you, I think it shows you the power of, you know, building that 5%, because you built the treasurers, then you added the AGs, then you added the congressional committee. And it was a matter, of two things happening, Joseph. One was people teaming up and cooperating. The cooperation was amazing. You know, and that's the beauty when you fight for freedom. Everybody just wants to be free, and the cooperation is fantastic. That was number one. But the thing I saw that was so gratifying to me and so powerful, and I've been waiting for 30 years to see it, the speed at which the AGs and the treasurers and Congress understood how this could be abused.
Oh, yes.
You know, they didn't just look at the regulation. They didn't just look at NAACs on the face of it. They looked at NAACs and said, how could the insane use this?
Right.
That was the key question. They said, we are dealing with insane people. How would insane people use this?
Right.
And for all my life, I've been struggling with people saying, how would sane people use this? Sane people would never do what
do
you're
it.
Suggesting. That's right. Right. So don't fall for it. Okay. Story number five, attacks on free speech intensify. And this is one of the most important areas for the rest of the year, because we've seen this wonderful lawsuit brought by Missouri and Louisiana, now called Murthy versus Missouri. Mm-hmm. It had oral arguments in the Supreme Court on March 18th, and it was scary. We heard the Supreme Court talking about, well, we wouldn't want to tie the hands of the government.
The Supreme Court today heard oral arguments in a First Amendment case experts say could have implications for the 2024 election. Murthy versus Missouri is a lawsuit against the Biden administration. It focuses on the government's communications with social media companies and whether the alleged conduct went too far in trying to counter disinformation online. Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall joins us now from the Supreme Court with the details. Tyler.
Hey, Kaylee, the name Murthy in this case might sound familiar because that's Vivek Murthy, the U.S. Surgeon General. He's one of numerous Biden administration officials being sued over allegations they crossed the line when it came to trying to tamp down and combat misinformation online. A group of social media users, along with two Republican attorneys general from Louisiana and Missouri, are alleging that key agencies within the Biden administration, like the CDC, essentially coerced big tech companies like Meta's Facebook and the platform from formerly known as Twitter, now X, to take down posts that it disagreed with. A lot of the content in question here has to deal with the pandemic, such as the origins of COVID-19 and the efficacy around vaccines, but it also extended beyond that. For example, posts related to the validity of the 2020 election results. So the big question here is, how far can the government go to encourage social media companies in their content moderating decisions, and whether or not that can veer into censorship?
So we're waiting for this decision. And, you know, Missouri and Louisiana are right. The government was violating the First Amendment, and it has to be stopped. Another thing we saw happen was South Dakota signed a hate crime bill.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which was, you know, hate crime is being used to... And if you look at the standards, they're very conceptual and confusing. You know, just as a matter of law, I spent 45 minutes trying to understand what were the standards that were being applied, and I couldn't figure it out. It was so murky and confusing. But it's being used to basically protect criminals. So I'll go back to my old friend Netanyahu. So I found myself through the first quarter having, you know, very tense arguments with American Christians who are, Israel can do no wrong. And I said, wait a minute, Netanyahu and his criminals, his criminal syndicate have killed God knows how many Israeli people with the pandemic.
I want to dispense with this American evangelical Christian Zionism thing once and for all. That whole interpretation of scripture is only recent in the last two centuries, and it is a uniquely American and British phenomenon. It is not the teaching of any sort of historical Christianity, not Roman Catholicism, not Orthodoxy, not Anglicanism, not Lutheranism, not Presbyterianism, not Methodism. No traditional form of Christianity, whatever it may be, has ever taught that idea. And the reason is very simple, people. The sacrifice of Christ put an end to all of that, and that means that Israel is the church. It has nothing to do with that group of people over in Palestine. Nothing. Nothing.
Right.
Zero. Right. Zilch, so, nada.
But let's go back and let's look at the country that is now called Israel.
Yes, okay? I know. Okay.
Okay. Netanyahu. So if you want to understand my grossly oversimplified version, and maybe we should go into this when we get to Gaza, but we'll do that in part two. My grossly oversimplified version of how Israel got created was you had three crime factions running America. You had the Vatican Line, you had the Masons, you know, under the Rockefellers, and then you had the Jewish crime syndicate. And they competed and collaborated. Right.
Yeah.
They competed and collaborated. And at some point, the Jewish faction in the National Crime Syndicate said to the Rockefellers, look, you guys have a sovereign nation. We want one too. Right. And so they cut a deal and they decided, okay, we create Israel for a variety of reasons. And you know, so you have some, but you got to do a lot of our dirty tricks, okay? Because you're small and nimble, you'll do a lot of dirty tricks for the other syndicates. Okay, so we create Israel, and let's fast forward to the last 3 years. The crime syndicate running Israel, which I would like to point out is more in the United States than it is in the Middle East.
In Israel.
Right.
That's right.
Specifically L.A. and Beverly Hills, you know, Beverly Hills. And Martha's Vineyard, where Obama has his two houses, which, according to his climate change model, should be underwater, but they're not. So I know many people who love the Israeli people and they love Israel. Netanyahu and his syndicate, how many people did they kill, disease, and disable in Israel with the pandemic?
I mean,
how many businesses were bankrupted? How many people were poisoned? How many people were killed? It was outrageous.
Yes, it was.
So Netanyahu is a criminal who killed, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or millions of Israelis Netanyahu has killed in the last 5 years. And that's before we go back to his various terrorist escapades and how many people in Israel that blew up. But I don't know how many people Netanyahu is murdered in Israel, but it's plenty. So if you love Israel, supporting Netanyahu to now kill the Palestinians, how is that?
Catherine, I'm at a loss.
The thing. These guys are passing hate crime bills to protect themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
I want to be very clear here when I say I'm at a loss. Number one, I support Israel's right to exist.
Right,
absolutely. Right. They're surrounded by a people and a culture that wants to get rid of them. Now, would I have supported the creation of Israel initially? No. But now that it's there, we can't go back and undo it. So that's number one. Number two, I do not support Israel's right to go in and slaughter a bunch of people.
Right, but that's not Israel.
That, okay?
The polls 6 weeks ago said 80% of Israelis wanted Netanyahu gone.
I know.
Okay.
And
so this is very
count right. me in that camp.
Right. So this is, you know, so we have to differentiate between the Israeli people,
right,
and the insane Israeli government. You know, I'm back to the sane and insane. Everybody I've ever met from Israel, except for Netanyahu, who is really from Philadelphia, not from Israel.
That's right.
And whatever that guy is at the World Economic Forum, what's his name?
I call him Der Hochklaus, Freiherr von Bloschwab und Brodiation.
God help me if I could ever quote that back to you. But anyway, the little ding dong at the World Economic Forum. So.
Yes.
So Netanyahu and the ding dong, you know, everybody I've ever met from Israel, I love. They're wonderful. Okay. These are great people. And you know, so I have no, anyway, so I love the Israeli people to the extent that I know them. But you know, the idea that those two should be protected because I love the Israeli people is nuts. Anyway, we'll go on because we'll talk about Gaza, you know, when we get to it. But, you know, the reality is the guys at 33 Liberty, all these laws are being passed to protect the guys at 33 Liberty in New York. That's the address of the New York Fed. You know, I think it's really important to see these bills are being passed to protect the insane. And we can't let that happen. No. Right. And one way to do it is instead of speaking with anger, you need to speak, you know, we need to make fun of them.
Yes.
So, So nobody, if you're laughing so hard, you're crying. It can't be called a hate crime, right? The other thing that was really interesting in the attacks on free speech, Matt Taibbi has been on a tear. First, he did the Twitter, you know, he did the Twitter files, and now, the New York Times did a hit piece on him that was so bad he even wrote an article about the New York Times hit piece where they accused him of getting his information from Mike Pence, and he had met Mike Pence after the Twitter files was over. So, you know, as we know, the New York Times often doesn't get their facts right. But anyway, but we are seeing an unprecedented war on the free speech. Yeah. Canada, we had Sean Buckley on the Saleri Report because they have a provision where you can arrest somebody because you think they might say something bad.
I know.
So this is the minority.
It's the
report.
Department of, yes, it is. It is the Department of Pre-Crime. Yep.
So let me ask you something, Joseph. You're looking at a leadership that believes they can control the narrative. And the narrative has now gone out of control.
Yeah. Catherine, I don't understand it either. It's a phenomenon that I've wrestled with ever since I've been doing this. You can go all the way back to my appearances on George Ann Hughes's Bite Show, and you know that's over a decade ago now, and we were wondering the same thing. Why are these people so insane? And the only thing that we could come up with, Catherine, and I think there's a great deal of truth in this. And you've pointed it out yourself that part of the insanity has to be mind manipulation. And I think part of that in turn is that these people have surrounded themselves with their own yes men for so long that they have imbibed the very insanity that they want to project on others. And they're caught like squirrels on one of those little wheels. They're just feeding their own insanity over and over again. And as they do, they become progressively more divorced from reality. So yeah, their narratives will eventually collapse because they're in the Soviet Union. They're trying to run the Soviet Union and it's collapsing.
Right. Well, it's devastating for productivity.
I
told you I was in a museum with the wonderful Nina Hein, and she she and Ulrich Groniger had gone off to look at a different part of the floor, and I was sitting in the gallery. There's one painting from the original donations that started the museum that was quite beautiful. It was Rosa Bonheur, and it was a picture of a cattle herd, and just exquisite. So I'm sitting on the sofa admiring it, and to my left is a woke, huge mural kind of painting that is one of the ugliest things I've ever seen.
I can believe it.
And a group come around to do a tour, and it's two young women wearing masks. And you have to wonder, what's the mask for these days? And they're wearing masks, but they're trying to describe this painting. And they're there for at least 10 to 12 minutes while I'm waiting for Uli and Nina. And they're talking about this painting as though it's a wonderful and exquisite piece of art. And it was remarkable.
Yeah.
And I kept trying to figure out, is it because they're paid to act like it's beautiful, or they're mind controlled to believe it's beautiful, or they've just been so overeducated? You know, I was trying to come up with a logical explanation of what I was hearing. And then I realized, oh, this is really demonic. I mean, you are trying to get a society to act like up is down and down is up.
And ugly is beautiful, yes.
And ugly is beautiful. And, you know, this is a kind of almost experiment.
It's Catherine, I know what you're talking about. The same thing has happened in all of the arts, music, literature. There's an ugly movement, and I'm quite serious. You told me once that you had contacted some musician to promote good music or something on your website, and then you heard one of his compositions and it was just awful or ugly or something. I don't remember exactly, but I can tell you that in the arts, particularly in graduate schools, in the academy, what you learn is ugliness. You learn how to compose. I'm very serious. This is an important point you're touching. You learn how to compose like Arnold Schoenberg more than you learn how to compose like J.S. Bach or Mozart.
Right.
You learn how to worship and produce ugliness. So in other words, what we're dealing with, Catherine, is a whole society and culture that is inside of the emperor's new clothes, that old fairy tale that we learned as children.
Right, but you're talking about an extraordinary multi-generational movement to ensure that human beings, well, it's a depopulation plan, really. So, but
ultimately,
it's
you're
looking to destroy the culture and you're looking to destroy the human inspiration, the human culture,
right.
But also you are systematically engineering an entire culture of people who have no power.
Right.
You know, you are getting people to embrace behavior that makes them powerless.
You're getting people to surrender their critical faculty and their inability to stand up and say that's ugly.
Right.
And once you surrender that innate human observation of the natural laws of beauty, transcendence, goodness, truth, once you get people to that stage, you've gotten them to where they have surrendered their humanity and human life itself is no longer valuable. That's precisely what all of this uglification is about.
Well, it was really funny because this collection was, you had really beautiful, the beautiful paintings from the original collection, then interspersed with all this
ugliness.
Just hideous, ugliness, just ugly, ugly. And Nina walked over and she looked at me and she was like, what is the organizing principle here?
Right.
And I said, woke incoherence. It is designed intentionally to make you feel incoherent.
Yes.
And then Nina looked at me and she just started to laugh and she said, you're exactly right. Okay, now, you know, she was looking for some sort of logic or pattern. No. So when I gave her that, she was like, oh, okay, now we understand what we're dealing with. Now we can have fun. Now we're going to approach this in a state of amusement. They're trying to make us incoherent and they can't.
Yeah.
And so we went on and the 3 hours that we had had reserved for seeing the collection got dropped to an hour. We were out of there in an hour.
I can believe
anyway,
it.
Which is great. It was great because I had a 22-hour drive into the heartland, so off I went. But okay, so that's the attacks on free speech. I just have to say to everybody, in every part of your life, fight for free speech.
Yes.
And if you're in a place where you're not allowed to speak freely, ditch them. Get out.
Yes, get out.
Get out. It's just shunning is one of the most powerful political tactics in the world. Just say, you know something? You're out. Drop them. So practice and exercise the free speech, because it really, this will get decided not just by the courts, but by the culture. Remember when everybody used to say, hey, it's a free country, you know, who cares what he said?
In the Orthodox Church, we have the practice of walling off. In other words, it's not just the hierarchy that excommunicates people. It's expected that you wall yourself off from other people that are evil influencers or bad influences and so on and so forth.
Right.
And that's just basically the ecclesiastical version of shunning.
Right.
Yeah, it needs to be done. It needs to be done.
People need to know this is not social.
Right.
Being against the First Amendment and free speech is not socially acceptable. You're out.
Right.
Go join the insane. We don't want you over here with the same people.
Right.
Okay, so story number six, the Fed fast payment CBDC lies in the war for deposits. So this is all the war we've been talking about in financial transaction freedom. But my favorite story of the quarter was Jay Powell, who's the chairman of the Federal Reserve, has been relatively careful to be sort of impeccable with his language.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've never seen Jay Powell pull an outright lie. And then all of a sudden in testimony in the first quarter, he says, we're not remotely close to doing CBDCs. And I said, okay, J-Pal, you have crossed the line. So Titus and I had a little discussion about it, Money and Markets, and we published a short about how Powell had crossed into the land of slippery language. And so I was talking to someone from Children's Health Defense, and they should we write an article? Well, they have a wonderful scholar named Michael Nevardarkis who writes for them. And so Michael contacted me and I sent him all my links and we went back and forth. And he wrote a fantastic article and just took it to a whole new level where, on one hand, he points out Powell is saying, we are not remotely close to doing a CBDC, but the Richmond Fed and the San Francisco Fed are putting out scopes of work at $150,000 to $200,000 a year to hire people to implement CBDCs.
Right.
Okay? So, you know, talking out of both sides of your mouth, you know, and I've been told, I haven't been able to track down, but Powell said he needed legislation to do a CBDC. Apparently he's backtracked on that, I was told, and I have to check it, saying now he can do it without a CBDC. But if you look at what the Fed is doing with the control grid and moving as clearly, as swiftly as they can to do the control grid, and the speed at which Michael Bloomberg is trying to cancel the Second Amendment, and meantime Powell saying, oh, we're not remotely close, you know, that's a flat-out lie, Jay.
All right. Yes.
You know, I respect the fact that he has tried not to be a flat-out liar, but he just crossed the line, in my opinion. And so now the chairman of the Fed is just flat-out lying to people in testimony about where they are in terms of building the control grid, because they're much further along than the American people can possibly imagine.
Yes.
And if you look at people getting thrown out of their bank accounts or their credit cards being turned down for certain kind of purchases or online payment systems throwing people off, you know, I'm sorry, Jay, you're lying.
Yeah.
So, and that to me is a line that's been crossed. And what it says to me is, it's like all the other diminutions of respectability in the corporate establishment. It, you know, this is a coup, and it's down to raw power now.
Yep.
So we've crossed a line. Anyway.
Yep.
But that was an interesting. And in fact, Titus, I don't know if you see Titus' new his new best evidence video. He let me go to Saleri and read you the title. So this is about Yellen saying that they can just take the Russian assets. So the title is "Please refrain from urinating on the rule of law, Madam Secretary." Well, but here's the thing.
That's true.
If Yellen takes the position that she and the G7 can just take the Russian assets and spend it on the war of Ukraine, mm-hmm. you know, any pretense that there's law in the U.S. dollar system and financial system is gone.
Right.
It's just gone. And, you know, we keep killing the goose that laid the golden egg, but if there's no law, how are you going to run a financial system?
I think probably I'm going to have to reserve my answer to the geopolitics when we get to it.
Right, right. So the question is,
if we get started on that now, I'm going to have a long rant.
Okay, so story number 7 is state banks and state bullion depositories. The sound money debate hits the states. So we talked about this when we went through the overview, but I spent a tremendous amount of time during the first quarter shocked and amazed at the lobbying by sound money people who don't understand the danger of a squeeze using bullion.
Yes, I agree.
They don't see the short squeeze coming.
No.
And I think it's wonderful that the states are starting bullion depositories and buying gold and silver. So I want to encourage that, but I want to stress again, we cannot allow ourselves to get short squeezed because we can't transact dollars.
Right. Right.
And, you know, I don't know anything to do but to keep saying it. And I've had to be very firm and stern with some pretty wonderful people who are saying, well, Bitcoin sound money or gold and silver are sound money. And if people don't own gold and silver, well, they should have been smart like me for the last 20 years. I have plenty of gold and silver. And they don't, I'm like, do you work for Mr. Global? You know, who are you trying to help here?
Yeah. Yeah. The bottom line is, let's go back to your idea of sovereign state banks. I think that's the best remedy against the possibility of a squeeze. And to all those that emailed me after that blog I wrote, you're forgetting I have never repudiated the idea that the amounts of bullion in the world are badly obfuscated. Right. And the reason they are is so that Mr. Central Bankster can play with them.
Right.
You know, I go back to what I wrote in Financial Vipers of Venice. Venice was able to manipulate the gold to silver bullion ratios and prices precisely because they had a secret source of gold.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I'm alive to that. And I think your idea of the sovereign state bank is the way to avoid that squeeze. And the other right. thing I'm going to insist on again is cash certificates of deposit, not the cards for any state bullion bank, and the ability to use those certificates of deposit as currency, as legal tender, because you're dealing in dollars.
Okay, so now I want to say something harsh, very harsh. We, and you and I have looked at and read and studied, we watched Russia, after the wall come down, be yes. absolutely raped
yes.
by a group of American law firms,
yes.
American university endowments,
yes.
and university American investment banks and private equity firms.
Yes.
They went in and they took. Yes. It was a taking. They yes. stole, they took. They teamed up, and U.S. intelligence agencies, they teamed up with the Russian mafia.
Yes.
And they raped the place. It was yes, a rape. It was yes, a great did. Taking. And that we have reports of as many as 10 to 25 million people losing their life because their bank accounts disappeared, their pension funds disappeared.
Yep.
You had hardworking, responsible people who had the system pulled out from under their legs, and we raped them and we plundered and we killed. Because you can engage in warfare with financial and legal systems. Yep. And you can kill millions of people with those financial and legal systems. And it was brutal. And it's well documented. Okay, so that was Russia. It was also in Eastern Europe.
Yes, it was.
Right. So we're talking about economic warfare, which can be, you know, you can kill a lot more people. You can kill as many people with economic warfare as you can kill with a bomb.
Yep.
So when the Fed instituted the going direct reset in 2020, from September, you know, 2019 to March 2020, how many people got laid off globally? 500 million? You know, how many people died from that? Millions. That's war by another. Okay, so let me keep going. Same thing in Latin America, right? We saw enormous, suddenly the banking system has deposits pulled or shut down, and suddenly everybody's got to barter, everybody's got to, you know, survive. We saw Nigeria implement CBDCs on a shock basis. We saw Modi pull cash notes on a shock basis.
Yep.
People starve. People die. Okay?
Yep.
So this has been going on around the world, certainly from the time that the Soviet Union collapsed. So from 1989, we have seen the top investment banks, intelligence agencies, law firms, big institutional investors engage in economic warfare that kills millions of people and steals their stuff.
Yep.
And in fact, for the annual wrap-up, I made a list of all the great takings that I could think of from World War II on. Or no, I think it was the World War I on, because I had the Great Depression. Okay. So we're talking about a leadership in America that engages in economic warfare that kills millions of people and steals their stuff.
Mm.
Okay. The latest was the pandemic. Mm-hmm. You shut down millions of businesses on Wall Street. You shift their market share to Wall Street. They made a fortune. It worked.
Mm.
Millions of people have died as a result. Okay. So we're talking about war and we're talking about death. And we're coming into a situation of great change, and we can manage it in a responsible way, or we can let them do it again. There is an assumption in this country, Joseph, wherever I go, in the citizens, the state leadership, the local leadership, that what went on in Russia can't happen here.
Oh, no, it absolutely can.
Well, I would say that there is infrastructure in place that we can work with to prevent it.
Yep.
So it is preventable here.
Yep.
But I have news for everyone. Go watch Charlie Ferguson's video, his documentary on the, you know, what was it? Wasn't No Exit. It was, I'll think of it in a second. But I keep recommending it. They destroyed the civic infrastructure of Iraq.
Yes.
Purposely.
Yes.
They destroyed it.
Yes.
So when the insane are free to engineer economic warfare against a society, you know, you could talk about things happening in America that could kill 25 million plus people.
Yeah.
You could talk about us all waking up and our bank deposits being just gone. Okay. So there's a notion that it can happen here, that goes on in other countries, but it doesn't happen here. And I want to disabuse everybody of that notion. It can happen here, and it will happen here if enough people don't stand up and stop it.
Yep.
And we, the sane, have the ability to stop it and turn it in a very positive direction. But if we don't, it can happen here.
It absolutely
now,
can.
Why do we believe that it can happen all around the world but not come here, when in fact it's our people doing it all around the world?
Is that a rhetorical question, or is it an actual one? Because I I think part of the answer, Catherine, is there are still a lot of people that believe the American myth, and I hate to put it, I'm going to be harsh now. The idea that we're the exceptional city on the hill, or the exceptional nation, that we are somehow, by dint and virtue of being Americans, exempt from that common pattern of all human societies in history is an absurdity. No one is exempt from the inheritance of ancestral sin, including the United States of America. So it can happen here. Our leaders are just as capable of foul deeds and evil and have done them. And I can think of one president in particular leading the list, and that's the self-righteous Woodrow Wilson. Talk about a guy that threw out the Constitution right there.
Right.
So, we need to look at our own history and understand that what you're talking about has been their playbook for a very long time.
Right. And one of the reasons I bring it up is I spend a lot of time listening to people talk about how enthusiastic they are about Trump returning to the presidency. And you know, Trump has led the greatest taking ever done in America to date. A greater taking arguably than the financial crisis and the Great Depression taking.
Yeah, the quack scene business, as I like to call them, that was when he lost me.
Well, but here's frankly. The thing. I'm not concerned about Trump. I'm concerned about people who are eager to support the next taking.
I don't know what form it's going to take, but I have to tell you, I'm still undecided as to whether or not I'm even going to bother with the federal elections this time around.
I always bother. You know, now there were two elections where I voted for Kelly Amir's brother as a write-in candidate.
Well, other than you, I don't know anyone that I would write in at the federal election level. I'm very serious, you know.
I would not make a good president, that I can assure you.
Well, I remember what you said in 2014 at the Secret Space Program conference. You wouldn't run unless you had 2,000 stormtroopers.
No. I said I wouldn't run unless I had 2,000 licenses to kill, no questions asked. You know,
well, okay, and, yeah, I forget yeah. exactly how you put it. Okay, licenses right. to kill rather than stormtroopers. Okay, there we go.
Well, no, some 2,000 stormtroopers would help, yeah. No, because yeah, you're would. Talking about, yeah, you can't run it. And I mean, we're in a very violent situation, and yeah, you would need it. You would need a president would need dramatic abilities to enforce. Okay, if you're going to change the model. Okay, so story number 8, the right to grow and market food, and the representative story here is farmer Amos Miller's war for food freedom. Yeah. There's been a huge war between one of the Amish farmers in Pennsylvania and the courts, of course, now in the middle of it. But right now we see all across Europe and all across America, farmers struggling for the right and communities for the right to grow and market food to each other. And this is the front line of the war.
Yes, it is.
And it's important because we can't remain healthy unless we have healthy food. And if you don't understand that, read Pharma Food. Did you get your copy of Pharma Food, Joseph?
Yes, I did.
Oh my God. That was the first time in my life I couldn't finish something in one reading. It was so horribly gruesome what they're planning for. And I had to take a break. And anyway, first time in my life, I could never read all the way through. Okay, let's go to story number 9. The land and real asset grab is on. And we talked about that with the NACs and conservation easements. And we talked about it in the overview. I want to focus again. There was this book that published recently called The Great Taking by David Webb.
Yes.
We had him on the Salera Report in December, and we finally got so many questions on this that Carolyn and I did an hour recording about why we disagree with David's analysis. And the one thing I would say is if you want to stop a great taking, you can't do it by outlawing or changing the laws. You've got to create, states have to create the operational capacity to do transactions in a way that Washington right. and Wall Street can't shut them down.
Right.
Anyway, so, you know, if you're worried about the great taking, you need to worry about financial freedom and states creating the conditions of sovereignty. Anyway, so one of the things I've said again and again, David's focused that the leadership might take securities. I'm not worried about the leadership taking securities. You know, they've printed more and more securities and more and more securities and more and more securities.
Yes.
Now the grab is for the real assets.
The real assets. Yes.
Right. Because if you look at the collateral fraud, they got a lot more paper.
Ding, ding, ding.
Then they got real assets. So, yeah. You know, so my focus is worry about the land grab. And, you know, if we look at every time they've played this disaster capitalism game, whether it's the Great Depression or the rape of Russia, you know, they're trying to get a hold of the assets that have value. And the big one is the land and real estate.
Well, in this respect, I go back to something we've been pointing out in for the past few years, is the amount of paper is so large.
Right.
Just this derivatives alone, that in order to balance the books with real assets, they're talking about mining asteroids. But I noticed the latest thing they're talking about, I don't know if you saw this blog on my website, but the latest thing they're talking about is mining assets from the bottom of the ocean,
right,
outside of national territorial waters. So in other words, these people, you know, forget about the securities in the paper. The problem is they have so inflated the financialization of everything. They've got to make a grab for the assets to back the system up.
Right. We'll get back to this on Gaza, but one of the stories of the quarter. I just couldn't believe this. Jared Kushner praises very valuable potential of Gaza's waterfront properties.
Yeah, I know.
So I used to have a friend who lived in New York who knew the Kushners, and she used to always say, those are dreadful people.
Well, they're not only dreadful, but this story comes out after this attack on Israel and after Israel's actions against Gaza. And then we find out, oh, there are oil deposits offshore.
Okay. So, yeah. So it was literally the war starts on October 7th, October 30th. Yeah. The Israel awards 12 new licenses to seven oil and gas companies. And the day after the big Italian company gets one of those awards, they drop out of the Silk Road. What a coincidence.
Yeah, what a coincidence. And
then, the Vandalay is coming to Israel to, you know, I mean, it's basically simple. Look, we need the land, we need the oil and gas, so we're going to move you to Egypt and take your stuff. and we're going to blow up. We're going to blow up all the housing, you know, so I think as of 2 months ago, FT had said, Financial Times had said 70 to 80% of the housing was gone. They just bombed it all and razed it. So, you know, this is pretty simple. Europe needs the oil and gas. We want the land and we need lots of Silicon Valley kind of space because we're going to be the cybersecurity, you know, go-to people for the control grid. Because, you know, it's Israel IT, which is very important and helpful to building the complete control grid. Anyway, so there's no subtlety in the taking at all. But for Jared Kushner to make that public and say that publicly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy who believes the hate crime bills are all going to protect him and he can say whatever he wants.
Yep.
Right? Okay.
Yep. Yep.
And the other thing is we see Lahaina. There's been enormous effort for years to get the folks in Lahaina to sell their land, and it wasn't working. And what do we see? Again, another taking.
Yep. Right.
So anyway, so the land and real asset grab is on, and I really want you to think about what are the jurisdictions in which you live? One of the reasons I specifically chose where I own my house in Tennessee is I figured it was the last place the billionaires would want. So I looked for a community where no billionaires would want to live there.
Believe it or not, when I bought this place, that was one of the considerations I had. You know, is this a place that anyone's going to want? And, you know, right. The answer
I
was
wanted
no.
to be.
Yep.
I wanted to be way out of the way. Okay. Yep. Last story. Story number 10, the politics and economics of mass atrocity. One of the things I never thought was that I would wake up and describe myself or find myself in a movie that combined, the Siege of Leningrad with the Stepford Wives.
Now, there's an image, Cass. Well, it's true.
Can you imagine being a soldier at the Siege of Leningrad and being required when you had dinner to pretend it wasn't happening?
No, I couldn't. No.
No.
No. No. No.
No, but think about it. That's remarkable.
It is. It is. Yeah, I get what you're getting at, and I think that's a good way of putting it. But I'll be laughing about that.
Well, but think about it. It's extraordinary.
It's really extraordinary.
You could engineer a mass atrocity. So it's funny. I just did an interview on the High Wire, and I was asked about immigration, and I said, "Well, this is really simple." Because I started off with talking about the number one cause of the diminution of family wealth was the great poisoning. Right. So the population is being poisoned. And yes. I went through all the, and it was very interesting because I don't know if you noticed at the meet and greet, this wonderful attorney came up to me and he said, "How can you say our children are being poisoned?" So I stepped him through. Well, there's, we talked about the fluoride. We talked
that.
About what's happening with food. We talked about the glyphosate. We talked about what's in the pharmaceuticals. We talked about what's in the spraying, and we were going on. And I said, and 54% of the kids have autoimmune diseases or chronic disease. And we've gone from 1 in 10,000 being autistic to 1 in, 30 plus being autistic, and I just read out the stats and he was looking at me realizing, oh, you're right.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny because, when you walk around, you go to a schoolyard in Europe, the kids are nowhere near as, they're much, much healthier. It's unbelievable.
Right. I know.
Right. And so, if you're not traveling and going to other countries, you don't see it as much. But anyway, so it's talking about the great poisoning causing such a significant diminution of family wealth and what the cost of a neurologically injured child is, et cetera. And so then Dell asks me about the immigration. And I said, well, it's really simple. You're poisoning your existing population and then you're bringing in replacement population. What's right. not to understand about this? This is really simple.
Right.
And sure, you've got designs and specifications for who you want to bring in and how you want to allocate them and use them. But it's pretty easy to understand. You're slowly poisoning one population and you've got a rise in all cause mortality and you're replacing it with a new population.
Yep.
What's not, this is simple. This is simple. And the thing that makes it difficult to grapple with is first of all, just facing that it's really that bad. But second of all is wandering around in a society where you have to pretend it's not happening. And that's the Stepford Wives aspect to the whole thing. But for me, there's a beauty in seeing it clearly and seeing it simply. Because once you see it and you get over the grief of this is really happening, then you can start to develop strategies to cope with it.
Right.
Right.
It's part of the Stepford Wives syndrome is the inability to see evil as evil, and it's more than just a difference now between the sane and the insane. What we're really dealing with is the difference between the sane and the criminally insane. Because right. That's what most of these people are. They're criminals.
Well, but I'm going to go back to being a tough guy. We have a very large segment of the population who is willing to go along and help them.
Yeah, I know.
For an attractive salary.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not, you can't blame that on the criminally insane. You know, those 15 engineers at Boeing were making and shipping out planes that weren't safe. And they were clearly taking the position, this is okay, I'm not responsible, I'm not to blame. And that is not acceptable. So
it's what happens in a society that tolerates someone like Biden Joe in the White House, because there is a man that is clearly a criminal. He's clearly nuts. He's lost his mind. And, you know, I've tried to drill this every opportunity I get on my website, that when you've made a career out of those kinds of rationalizations, the same kind of rationalizations these engineers at Boeing have done, what you end up with is a society being run by the criminally insane. And I would put those Boeing engineers in the category of criminally insane, because what you're doing is you're rationalizing something that's against your own conscience.
Right.
And that is a first step towards that criminal insanity. When you willfully force yourself into a position that you know is morally wrong. And those engineers at Boeing knew that what they were doing was morally wrong.
Well, it's interesting. One of my favorite sort of scriptural discussions is what the fear of the Lord means. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine being a Boeing engineer and going along with that for a long period of time, because I'm way too afraid of the Lord to do that.
Yeah. I can't imagine it either.
I know that he and I see everything I do, right, and there are consequences. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I in my life have been protected by miracles.
Oh, same here.
I don't want to lose those miracles. I don't want to lose, if you understand the love of the Lord, you will do anything not to lose it.
To lose it, right.
Anything. I can't imagine, you know, I am afraid of losing the love of the Lord. And that's why I can't imagine doing what they're doing, because why would you give up the most precious gift you ever got? You know, there's the gift of life, and with it, there's the gift of the love of the Lord. How could you give that up?
The first step is when you convince yourself that there is no such thing as the love of the Lord. That's the first step. We have essentially a materialistic and atheistic society in this country, and I know that goes against everything about the American myth that people think. But the great God in general of Freemasonry that set this country up, and I'm not pulling any punches here, people have got to understand this. That is not the same thing as what you're talking about with the fear of the Lord. Because
what do you
for
mean?
You, what I mean is for you, God is not the great God in general. For you, God is Christ.
Right.
And his Father and the Holy Spirit. It is not right. Some vague philosophical concept that you're going to get when they rip the hoodwink off of your, you know, off of your face at the third degree. It's not something that vague.
No, it's very
real, and it's very personal, and there's a real character associated with what you believe. And that's my point.
Well, we have a society that's lost, that has no understanding, you know, I hate to say it, of plasma.
This America is the most theologically illiterate country in the world.
But it's scientifically illiterate, because what you're saying is you reality is what you can see. The invisible isn't real.
Yeah, we are in a country that has so lost its grip on truth, goodness, morality, and reality that we're having arguments on what bathrooms to use and what a woman is. Now,
you know, that's just, to me, that's just a distraction, but
it's not a distraction. It is a symptom of what we're talking about. It is what happens when you have people like Joe Biden or the Boeing engineers rationalizing their participation in something that is that evil.
Well, but you're also trying to, you know, if you're engaged in a mass atrocity against the population, it pays to spend a lot of money on distracting them and entertaining them they won't notice.
Right.
So let me mention a couple of stories that I thought were particularly interesting in this area. One is Kevin McKiernan, the scientist, announces the S-40 in the injections. And it's one of those indicators that this was all intentional.
Oh, yes.
In other words, this is very, very intentional. Another one was we had German scientist Michael and Dr. Michael Nails on the Soleri report talking about the extent to which the spike protein attacks the hippocampus and interferes with cognition and increases the ease with which make people afraid and put people in fear. If you haven't listened to that interview, Joseph, it's astonishing. And he's absolutely clear this has to be intentional. This can't be an accident or a coincidence.
That's right.
No. This was an engineered targeting of people's ability to think clearly.
Oh, I can. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If what he's saying, what you just outlined is true, it has to be. Holy cow.
So then a second one was Andrew Brigden put out a tweet saying one of the ministers that he was personally close to was angry at him for opposing the vaccinations and came over and said to him, well, you've been vaccinated, which means you're going to die of turbo cancer soon. So let me get the exact quote. The vaccinated will soon begin dying in their hundreds of millions, according to a British member of Parliament, Andrew Brigden, who revealed a senior cabinet minister told him details of the plan to use turbo cancer to depopulate the world. According to Brigden, the incident took place in the tea room at Westminster Houses of Parliament, where the unnamed senior minister told him that he would be, quote, dead of cancer soon because he was misled into taking the vaccine during the lockdown. Quote, and this he tweeted this out, so he describes it. You can speak all you want, the minister told Brigden. Quote, it doesn't matter. You are vaccinated. You will be dead of cancer soon.
I can believe it because one of the other things that I've been kind of privately watching as a result of the quack scenes and the injections is not only, you know, what's going on at Boeing, but all the craziness in the airline industry. Pilots dropping dead. Crazy conversations. You can go on YouTube and listen to some of these. I mentioned it in your last Soleri wrap-up. Crazy conversations between air traffic controllers and pilots. Just crazy.
Uh-huh. Right. You
know, there's either a brain fog on the part of the cockpit crew or the air traffic control crew or both. And to me, it's frightening.
Right. And it could be EMF too.
It could be all combinations of all the above.
Right.
You know, I still don't rule out of question the idea that they have engineered these quack scenes to be resonant to certain frequencies or even to be capable of, you know, through the nanotechnology that's been alleged, being capable of picking up broadcast signals. So the whole thing was engineered from the get go.
Right. Right. Well, we're seeing the reason I bring this up is people are bringing out evidence and bringing out stories that prove that this was a mass atrocity.
Yes.
And it's very interesting. Newsweek just had a new piece describing the fact that Trump was running into problems because of his position. He's still bragging about rolling out the vaccines.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, we're recording this essentially you know, on Easter weekend in March, and last day, you know, so it's
Western
March 30th.
Western Easter.
But we're recording this the last day of March. The election's not till November.
Right.
A lot of people are going to die between now and November, and I can't believe that's not going to have an impact.
That's kind of a frightening take. I'd never thought about that. Yeah.
Well, think about it. What are between now and the end of the year? You know, I just saw a presentation by a scientist. He says the turbo cancers are dramatic in the booster population. So the people at one and two aren't getting this dramatic rise in turbo cancer. His supposition. He says the dramatic rise in turbo cancer is in the people who took the boosters. So, you know, but if that's true, you're going to see, and if what Brigden is being told, you're going to see an acceleration of the rise in all-cause mortality. And that's going to have a dramatic impact on both politics and economics in ways I don't feel we understand, Joseph.
Yeah.
But I think we need to think about them. And, you know, and we need to understand what it's like to operate. So I was giving one of our team members a hard time because she was in a state of grief about somebody who died as a result of the vaccine. And she was driving with us and just was in an incredible state of grief. And I was like, you know, if you look at what's going to happen over the next or could happen over the next 2 years, you know, we need to find a way of emotionally navigating this. Because if every day you're spending your day overwhelmed in grief instead of, you know, being able to live your life and get, you know, it makes you sick to spend your life in grief.
Right.
So I go back to we're in war conditions. How do we deal with death in war conditions in a way that, you know, I want everybody listening to this call to, you know, to navigate this environment successfully. And
well, we have to. One way to do it is start looking at these types of deaths as casualties in the war.
Right.
You're Absolutely. Sad for them. You're sad for them, but by the same token, you recognize as a casualty, it need not have happened, and that there's an enemy that is responsible for it.
Right. And I want you to take out your grief on the enemy, right. not yourself. Right. Right. Okay. Okay, well, that's it for our top 10 stories. So let me just run through them again. So we went through the overview. Then number one, the feds weaponized the financial system. Number two, Congress fails while the states grapple with their new roles. Number three, ESG, climate change, and the run on BlackRock and the Net Zero Alliance. Four, state treasurers and AGs exercise their power next bite the dust. Five, attacks on free speech intensify. Six, the Fed fast payment CBDC lies in the war on deposits, for deposits. Seven, state banks and state bullion depositories, the sound money debate hits the states. Eight, the right to grow and market food, farmer Amos Miller's war for food freedom. Nine, the land and real asset grab is on. 10, the politics and economics of mass atrocity. Needless to say, what I'm seeing is enormous pushback. Enormous.
Right. Right.
All across the board. And that is creating high friction.
Yeah.
And that friction is only going to grow over the next quarter.
Yeah.
So all I can say, and I would point out that this has been a very domestic conversation to the United States, because we made a command decision that our push for financial transaction freedom would be in the United States. That's where we thought we had the best shot. Yeah. But what I want to see is that financial transaction happening all over the world.
All
I want to see
it
happening throughout the Commonwealth nations. I want to see it throughout Europe, all throughout the world. And so I'm hoping if you're not in the United States, you can still glean ideas and things that will help you where you are. Anyway, any thoughts about what's coming for the next year in these areas, or any other wrap-up thoughts you want to have, Joseph?
No, I think we pretty well covered it, and I do think this is going to be the year of the pushback. I really do think it's going to be the year where, not necessarily that we're gonna start to see success, but at least in the sense that we're gonna start understanding that this was a pivotal turning point year.
Right.
This was the year that battle was joined, because that's what's happening.
Absolutely. And I have to say, the most fun I've had in the first quarter is I'm in someplace with a group of freedom fighters and we're working and something magical is happening. And it's just beautiful. And that's why I say, get off the couch. Everybody's different. Do the actions that you can do. Take action, because I got to tell you, you have this wave of pushback and it's turning the ship. And when you're in the middle of it with these people, it is marvelous. It is just, you know, and the divine intelligence is present.
Yep.
It's always there. It's always present. And it's a, you know.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's another thing that we need to remember. If Mr. Globalone was able to have 100% success, we would already be in the tyranny that he has planned.
Absolutely.
So there's pushback coming from somewhere, and there have been just enough upsets that his plans have not come to fruition. So keep at it.
Yep.
You know, keep at it.
Take action. Okay. We'll be back next week with part two. We're going to be covering the second group of stories, 11 to 20. Unanswered questions and inspiration. So thank you, Joseph. See you next week.
Thanks for having me, Catherine. Bye-bye.